Well, a couple of us need Jesus. Mr. Mkhalipi, you are welcome. Yes, sir, welcome. With us here, we have our facilitators, Mr. Roskam and Mr. Todd. They will be taking us through the new legislation. And then after that, we can engage. The idea is to... This is the second leg of our workshop. Yesterday, we had a workshop where we were looking at the legislation as it is now. And maybe what are the things that are making things difficult for us to be able to do our work. And then today we'll be looking at what are the new what are the bills saying in terms of helping us to achieve our goals, to make our work much more easier. My name is Alec Nchaveleng. I'm the chairperson of the committee. And I'll ask all members to introduce themselves so that our facilities that don't refer to us, you with the red tie, they will know who you are. let's fire out.
I'm a member of the committee. My name is Serge Motau, it's spelled S-E-J, and the last name is M-O-T-A-U.
My name is Adrian Williams. I'm a member of the committee.
Morning. Eric Nyagapa.
Morning.
Member of the committee.
That's a
good
time, Paul. Yes. Marcel Romulo, member of the committee. Department of Labor. Columbia, Department of Labor.
Anton Albert, member of committee.
Andrikus van der Westhuizen, also a member of the committee. And if it seems to you like too nadering on this side, there's no special meaning to be found to the fact that the DA and the Freedom Front is now sitting next to
drafting the memorandum of the objects of the
of the bills, and everything I think that could be put into a presentation is in those memoranda already. So I didn't want to just regurgitate the same thing over and over again. So if you've got those two bills, then those are the only documents that we are going to refer to. And the memoranda as well, although it doesn't seem that the memoranda are in here, in the or at the back. Okay, so we start on page 26 of the LRA.
Thanks very much.
And what we intend to do is refer to the memoranda and then go back to the actual drafting there. But perhaps before we embark on this exercise, may I suggest, Chairperson, that it not be just a simple presentation and then questions and answers, that members be able to engage on the issue as we're dealing with it. I'm quite happy to deal with interruptions and questions and clarifications as we're going along. And I'm sure Chris is as well. And of course we have Kalipi from the department who's been integral to the negotiations in Midland and could also be of assistance in clarifying any matters. I must say that I was appointed to the NEDLAC drafting team by the Labour component of NEDLAC, the Labour constituency, and Chris was appointed to the NEDLAC drafting team by the business component constituency, and Paul Benjamin, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, was appointed by the government to be on the drafting team. And the process of engagement at NEDLAC has been one in which the parties have attempted to reach some kind of consensus. They then referred that matter to the drafting team. The drafting team has produced a draft which has then been engaged upon by the social partners. And there's been a to-ing and fro-ing between the drafting team and the social partners. I will attempt as best as I can to reflect some of the considerations, but obviously if I leave anything out, Chris can add in, and I'm sure Kalipi can add in as well, so that you get as balanced a picture of the issues as possible. I think one other preliminary point, and then I'm going to dive right into the issues. And that is that when considering these issues, one's got to bear in mind that we are dealing with national legislation, and that when you consider an employee or a worker being a broader term than employee, or an employer, we are talking about vastly different kinds of animals, inverted commas, in the sense that we are not only dealing with low-income workers who are on the factory floor, such as a clothing and textile worker. We're also dealing with public sector. We're also dealing with, when you use the word employee, middle-level employees. We're also dealing with senior executives, because all of those people are employees. So when drafting legislation, one of the very difficult things is to bear in mind the different kinds of employees and different kinds of employers that we have in the country. And it's not possible to just simply draft having only one kind of worker in mind or one kind of employer in mind. One has to cast legislation bearing in mind the implications it has for a whole range of people. And that makes labour legislative drafting and negotiations immensely complex, because when you write down a law, it has so many ramifications for various areas. So I think that is one of the important things that has to be considered. I think the other thing that is very important to consider here is that these amendments are not a wholesale redrafting of the labor dispensation that was agreed to in 1995. They are an amendment and refinement of the basic processes and policies that were agreed to at that time. I think we would have a fundamentally different thing if there was a whole-scale redrafting. But here we are dealing with specific problems in the main area that has been of great concern has been the area of atypical employment or non-standard employment. I suppose that's been the biggest area of negotiation, but there's been a myriad of other things that have been considered as well. So the basic thrust of a process of regulated flexibility, which was the phrase that was coined to underpin the policy behind the Labor Relations Act and the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, still remains in place. And one is now dealing with refinements in relation to things that have changed over time. So I thought what we should do is start with the Labor Relations Bill and engage on the first areas, and then we'll move on to the basic conditions. I don't mean to simply say that one is more important than the other, but I think it's more difficult. The labor relations area is probably more complex and needs to be engaged on first. The first thing you'll see as you open these pieces of paper is the question of organizational rights. And there have been a number of amendments in relation to organizational rights. Now, you recall that what the Labor Relations Act does is it gives rights to trade unions in certain circumstances to rights in the workplace, rights of access, rights of trade union subscriptions or stop orders, as they are commonly referred to, disclosure of information, those kinds of things. There is no fundamental amendment here except a tinkering, if I may put it in that way. And in essence, what it does is saying, if you look at the nature of the workplace, and it has changed over time since 1995, more and more of the workers within the workplace are non-standard in type of employees. And what do we mean by non-standard? We mean people engaged by labor brokers, people on fixed-term contracts, people on part-time contracts, those kinds of things. And so when trying to obtain organizational rights, the trade unions have found it sometimes more difficult to obtain them because organization of non-standard type employees is more difficult generally. And so what is being put up is that the composition of the workforce must be taken into account when determining organizational rights. Now, there are certain organizational rights that you can only get if you're a majority trade union. In other words, you've got 50% plus one. And there are certain organizational rights that you can get, like trade union access, if you are sufficiently representative. And sufficiently representative is something that is determined in the context of the type of employer. Now, I'll give you the classic example. The pilots, probably in SAA, are probably, 5% of the employees of SAA? It would be ludicrous not to give them organizational rights, because at the end of the day, if they go out on strike, the entire thing goes down. They're very, very powerful, even though they're only 5% of the employees. So you've got to take those kinds of considerations into account when looking at sufficiently representative. Now, in other contexts, you might have lots of employees who are labor brokers, labor broker employees, fixed-term contract employees and part-time employees. Part-time work employees. So those factors should be taken into account. The other consideration is that that a trade union that does not have a majority membership among employees may be awarded the right for its members to elect shop stewards under this area. Now, this is an area in which usually you had to be a majority trade union in order to get those rights, and that area has been relaxed, provided that there is no other majority trade union there. So if you're in a workplace and, let me use an example, NUMSA, as I was speaking to one of the members who came from NUMSA, occupies 40%, they may be able to get shop steward rights. One of the problems that we have, or that trade unions face in this scenario, is that the number of employees in a workplace, but generally employees, trade unions only bargain for a certain category of employees, which are commonly referred to as bargaining units. But when determining the majority, you count right up to the CEO. And so the greater the number of people in middle level and upper echelon employees, the more difficult it is to gain that majority status. So in those circumstances, they can give shop stewards rights, provided that there is no majority trade union there. So that's a relaxation of that. The other area is a relaxation of this question of a threshold. Section 18 of the LRA says that a trade union who's a majority trade union and the employer can establish a threshold for getting organizational rights. So, for example, Union A says, we've got a majority. In order to in order to obtain organizational rights, you have to have 45% membership. We are 50% or 55%. In other words, they exclude every other trade union from the process. Now, that's an acceptable practice and has been an acceptable legal practice from the point of view of what the ILO recommendations are. But often in those circumstances, you do have a very significant union that maybe has 20%. That occupies certain categories of employees, maybe at middle level or in a particular grouping of the workforce, and they should be able to get organizational rights. So despite that majority threshold, the CTMA has been empowered through these amendments to be able to give certain organizational rights to those trade unions, provided that they already have the organizational rights in 12 and 13. And that is trade union access and deduction. So in those circumstances, a significant trade union can still get organizational rights despite an agreed threshold determined by the employer and the majority trade union. The last, the other area is that employees engaged by a temporary employment service, commonly referred to as a labour broker, may be regarded as forming part of the workplace of the temporary employment service or of the client where they work. And the reason for this is the classic example. It was a case at, I think, WITS, if I recall correctly, where the WITS University engaged a labour broker, and the labour broker's employees said, please, can we have rights of access? And the labour broker said, yes, you can have rights of access at my premises, which are, I can't remember, but probably on the East Rand somewhere. And yet they were working at WITS University, which is in the middle of Johannesburg. So it makes very little sense to have those kind of rights so far away from your workplace. So here it's saying that you may be given those organizational rights at the client. And then the other area is that the organizational rights may in fact affect third parties. In other words, if you're given rights of access and you are a retailer in a mall, it might affect the rights of the mall owners. And therefore, those rights should be able to be enforced against third parties, such as the mall owners, provided that the mall owner has had an opportunity to be properly heard in relation to those matters. And that's the amendment to Section 22.
Can you expand on that one? For example, when people want to strike and other shop owners can't get access, or the clients are intimidated, or is not, where does the shopping mall?
Well, I'm going to come to that. That's in relation to picketing. This is only in relation to organizational rights. So maybe we should deal with it when we come to picketing, because that's a different issue. But this is saying, can a trade union organizer get access to the, premises when the premises are in fact owned by a third party and they might need to go through the third party's premises? I think this is of less controversy than the picketing one. But it also then protects the rights of the third parties by making sure that you can't enforce those rights against the third party without them being heard and taking into consideration the issues. I'm going to pause at that point because that's the amendments to organizational rights. I don't know if Chris wants to add anything at this point or any further questions.
Maybe I can just say that the overall implications of this section, this group of amendments to organizational rights, does make it a bit easier for non-majority, smaller trade unions to get access to rights. I think I agree with Antal, it's a very slight easing in the ability of non-majority unions to organize. And in some ways, it just breaks the stranglehold that a majority union could have on a workplace. When the LRA was first enacted, a big discussion was whether to allow closed shops, what were called closed shops, where a majority union can actually force union membership of the majority union. And what was introduced, you may or may not remember, was the concept of the agency shop, which has actually been the only union security arrangement used, where you could get a fee from non-members, but you couldn't force them to join. But the point really here is that now majority union can't completely control a workplace. Smaller unions may have it slightly easier, either to gain shop stewards as a matter of right, or to get organizational rights, even if a majority union has tried to exclude them. So for that reason, actually, it's supported by the union federation that tends to be the minority union in the workplace, and might have been opposed by Cassata trade unions, but hasn't been. They've sort of accepted that as a weakening of majority control. The only other thing to point out is that even though, effectively what this is doing, the structure of the LRA on organizational rights is that you can always bargain for organizational rights. If you pilot and you can mobilize a strike over 5%, even though you only represent 5%, that's probably the number one route to get the employer to give you organizational rights. You're only expected to go to the CCMA as a default provision to give you a basic access if the employer is refusing in circumstances where logically you should be. So in a sense, we're slightly tinkering with that legal structure for access to organizational rights, but I think it doesn't change the primary route, which is to negotiate and use what in labor relations terms is called power play to get access to workplaces and organizational rights.
Well, you have a new chair in place, so I cracked the whip for a little while. I defer to you, Anton, so you can lead the proceedings. We've agreed that we will interject so that we can have a conversation, as we've done. Okay. Okay.
Well, so that really deals with the first page 26 of the memorandum. Are there any? Sorry, big question.
I understand from your
position. It's you. Substitute voice, use it.
It's Wagner. Am I audible?
Yeah.
I think that we are done with the area of adversarial life, and then we move them to another area within the bill. Maybe I misunderstood you. The threshold is still there, even if there are these new amendments. It's not something that has been done away with.
The officials be agreed upon.
Yes. Now, if then through the process of the CCMA, then the threshold has been established. Are the smaller unions still have to exist even if the last threshold? That one, the link to this is on the area of you made an example of the closed shop and the agent shop, which I think those are two different sections in the current LRA. So the discussions that NEBLA on the amendment of the LRA, we didn't spoke to those amendments.
The threshold still remains there. In other words, but it's not a threshold that's determined through the CCMA. Remember, it's determined by agreement between the employer and the majority trade union. The question then is, can a significant minority union still exercise certain organizational rights, not all of them, but certain of them, such as access, and what's the other one? Stop orders. Access and stop orders, despite that agreed threshold. And under certain circumstances, taking into account the considerations put into the bill, the CCMA can say, despite that agreed threshold, you will have those particular organizational rights. So it undermines the majoritarianism inherent in that threshold agreement, but it is limited only to those organizational rights and to a significant minority union.
Can I just do it?
Yeah, still on that. If I may, please.
You are speaking to an old-fashioned thinking person. If you say 5%, what exactly are you saying? In terms of the minority, you know, 5%, what does it mean in real figures? 50 human beings? 100 human beings? What does it mean? I mean, if I have to explain to a my grandmother, what should I say? 5%, what is that? In real human beings calculation.
Chair, can I ask you that? I mean, that question is, the thresholds are referred to, I mean, they're not actually set at percentage levels in the Act. The main threshold, there are two thresholds talked about. One is sufficiently representative, and lawyers especially and trade unions love and employers arguing about what is sufficient, and the LRA leaves that. It just leaves it because it's treated as something that could be different at any enterprise, and it's not treated as an actual number. And in response to your question, there is no numerical threshold in terms of numbers of workers, except when it comes to shop stewards. In other words, when you get rights to shop stewards, to know how many shop stewards you should have in that workplace, there are number thresholds where it's 1 per 50 or 1 per 2 per 200 or whatever it is, are set up in the Act. But as to what is sufficient, it's normally talked about in percentage terms, but 5% of 100 is 5, 5% of 1,000 is 50, and so on. So it depends on the size of the enterprise. Pilots and SAA, I don't know what their percentage is, but they're probably 100 or 200 or 300, I don't know. Pilots and SAA, but it's only about a small percentage of SAA. Can I just quickly give practical examples just to answer the first question as well? Just two simple points that illustrate this issue of the threshold. At the moment, a 40% union will almost certainly be entitled to stop orders and access, but it wants shop stewards to represent workers at the workplace. The only way at the moment it can get shop stewards, if it's 40%, is threatening power and persuading the employer with a strike if necessary to give it shop stewards. That's the situation at the moment. The incentive to it is if you want to create shop stewards as a matter of law, you have to have 50% plus one. You have to have a majority. So at the moment, the 40% union can only win shop stewards by power, and it needs to get its membership up to 50% plus one to get shop stewards without a strike, just by being automatically granted them. After the amendment, the 40% union could, instead of using power, try to go to the CCMA and persuade it that even though I'm not 50% plus one, I should be given a right to shop stewards without a strike and without using my power play. So that's the one change on shop stewards. And in relation to the second point Anton explained, where there is a majority union that has excluded other unions by saying, for example, you can only get stop orders if you represent 45% or 50% plus one. But let's say I've got 60%, and I know if my agreement says you have to have 45 to get any basic access to the premises, I'll exclude all other unions. And I think it's actually very rarely used. I'm not aware of any workplaces, but my practice is more for employers than workers. But I don't think that any trade unions have really used that. But the Act says it was recognized as something that majority unions could really dominate and have a grip on the enterprise. And it's relaxed that so that the minority, a union that's a significant, that says I've got 50%, which normally would be enough for organizational rights, it's excluded by that agreement with the 50% union. I can still go and try and persuade a commissioner at the CCMA that I should get those organizational rights. Those are the two changes. I don't think it is an open-ended ruling because you can't strike on that matter only for the next 12 months. There might be changes. But I don't think that the Commission is excluded from putting conditions associated with it because there might be, you are at 30% and therefore I'm granted, but if you go below 30% then I'm not, this will not change. I would imagine the Commission can make that kind of decision.
Is it not right that we should be writing into
that? Can I just chip in there?
Sure.
Chair, through you, Chair. The structure of the Act at the moment is that if a party to a ruling of the Commission believes that circumstances have changed or the thresholds or the representations dropped, it has a right to go back to the Commission and say, you've made a ruling, but that was when the union was at 30%. It's now dropped to 25%. We say that you should change your ruling. So Section 21, which gives Commission-based, because the Commission has power to grant those rights, has got a right to approach it again for a change of circumstances. The structure of the Act is to try, before the Commission makes a ruling, actually try and force the parties to conclude a collective agreement. And collective agreements can be changed by giving notice to counsel. But if they can't agree and the Commission makes a ruling, then you can't unilaterally change that ruling. You stay, if you think it should change, you go back to the Commission.
The process is defined in Section 21, I think it is here. I think you could debate this for the next week. In fact, at NEDLAC, I think there were a few days on organizational rights as everyone considered the various permutations of these kinds of things. I think the inherent response from business and from at least the Kasatu unions was, do we want to temper with the majoritarianism principle? But as the discussions took place, they were willing to relax that because, in general, I think this probably reflects a lot of what the practice is already. So if you look at, for example, the mines, even where, say, for example, NUM has a majority, is recognition of other unions in that workplace, given the significance of those kinds of unions. So I don't think this departs too much from what the practice is actually on the ground, in my view. But this is something that can be debated for a very long time.
From industry to industry, and the management of that industry, how open-minded are they? Like if you've had 100 people and the union represents 20, and 15 of them are not unionized, and somebody has about 30-something percent of those, the margin is very minimal. So, and it don't even cause us any stress to recognize both unions and have them, do their subscriptions. It's not going to hurt anyone. And many companies will do that. And not only the mines where you find, and you have as a majority, but solidarity will be recognized because it does recognize a sizable number of workers who cannot be ignored simply because of numbers. But it doesn't take the rise of the majority union. They will still have more representative than all these other small unions. But it won't change the price of bread not to give them some rise so that they can represent their workers in the factory, even access.
All right, can I suggest we move on then to the collective bargaining area? And I think, Chair, that probably sums up what I think the attitude of a lot of the parties at NEDLAC was in relation to the being practical about this kind of matters. One of the key issues is an amendment to Section 32 of the Act. Now, Section 32 is a very, very important provision because in terms of this provision, if the majority of employers are and the majority of trade unions representing the majority of employees in an industry agree on terms and conditions of employment, they can ask the Minister of Labour to extend that agreement to all non-parties, and through collective bargaining they establish the floor of rights, or the, not just the floor, but the rights that exist in that particular industry. So as an example, in the, Adrian's X area, in the local government area, there would be negotiations between SAMU and Amatu and SELGA, SELGA representing the employers, SAMU and Amatu representing the workers. They would come to an agreement around wages and terms and conditions, and then they would ask for that agreement to be extended to all non-parties
by the Minister of Labour. Might not be the best example because I don't think that they need to extend, given that all employers are in the bargaining council, but certainly in the private sector, such as NUMSA and CIFSA, there would be an extension of that agreement. Two controversies have arisen. One is the issue of exemptions. In other words, you can't extend those agreements without a proper process for exemptions. So if you are a ailing business and you're about to go under, can you apply for an exemption to that collective agreement in order to keep yourself alive and keep those jobs alive? And those exemption procedures have been in place for a long time, but in certain bargaining councils, they are not very efficient. And so the process is that there's now a prescription in here to say that they have to be dealt with in 30 days of the agreement being extended, and that the appeals in relation to those exemptions, which have to be heard by an independent person, has to be all then dealt with in 30 days from the appeal being lodged. So that's an attempt to try and, in certain industries they're very efficient, and in certain industries they're not, but this is an attempt to try and make them more efficient in those situations. The other thing is that in terms of Section 32, the minister is required to extend the agreement if the trade union and the employers represent the majority of employees. The minister has no discretion to say, I don't want to extend this agreement. She has to do so, provided the criteria are met. But she also has, where there are sufficiently representative, but not a majority, she has a discretion to extend the agreement. And the controversy that's arisen here is, if she has that discretion, does she have to ask for public comment before she extends in terms of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act? Because she is, in essence, creating legislation, delegated legislation. So, obviously, one has to bear in mind that this could be a very, very laborious process. It could affect or delay things dramatically if you had to go through an elaborate process here. So the amendment defines what that process should be for public comment, and therefore tries to streamline it as much as possible. That's in relation to where she has a discretion. Where she has no discretion, in other words, she must just check that the requirements have been met, there is no requirement for public comment. And I think that generally reflects what people have thought was the law in any way, but we are clarifying it through this amendment and streamlining it. You want to add anything?
I don't want to sound as though I have to have it with my own word in as well, but this section, bargaining councils, it was fundamental to the structure of the labor relations act. The idea, again, promoting law, typically the majoritarian system, is that an industry, the majority of workers and employers in an industry, can actually set conditions for the whole industry. And it's controversial, that proposition, because it means businesses, or unions say, but typically it's businesses, that aren't part of that bargaining, don't belong to the employers' organizations, and are not interested, just want to run their own business, find somebody coming along and saying, by the way, this is what the wages are in your industry. So it's a mechanism for collective bargaining at industry level that was strongly supported in a majoritarian type situation, or in certain circumstances, even when the employers and employees don't represent majority, that's where the minister has a discretion. Only point of mentioning it is that actually this whole system is under serious attack at the moment from employers' organizations representing those outside the collective bargaining. So there's groups of employers' organizations that represent typically smaller employers that are outside the industry bargaining arrangements, that are launching a series of court attacks to say effectively this is infringing their rights by allowing unions and employers who are actually their competitors to tell them how much they have to pay or what conditions they have to apply in their workplace. So these measures, these small amendments provide support and possible defenses to those who want to support and maintain that bargaining system, because they are actually dealing with loopholes that people who are outside that system are arguing to undermine the industry bargaining arrangements. I don't know if that's it's more of a policy consideration, but it is really the rationale for these amendments, I think.
I'm going to pause there because it's an important amendment, an important area. I don't know if there's any questions.
I'm getting complaints from... Thank you, Chair. I'm getting complaints from employers who say they are going to have, especially with the economy that we've lost over the last few years. And yet the bargaining councils take a long time to deal with those exemption applications. It seems to me that if I read correctly, this 30 days there's no supplicate on the bargaining council to deal with it in 30 days. The place where it fits into the legislation says the minister must be satisfied that they would be able to deal with it in 30 days. Shouldn't we make it stronger? Because the problem is, you know, if a company is about to fail, you can't wait for a year, you know, to get feedback on your application. I don't know if I've put it there.
No, the question I was going to ask is that, let me take maybe an example of I'm running a very small engineering company in Port Arthur, and then Nyakemba, he's from Port Arthur, but he worked in Johannesburg at some company, and then he knew something about unions, and he comes back from the small union in Port Arthur, and then he enters into an agreement with me concerning wages. I'm not part of the of SAFE. He's not part of any federation. But we enter into an agreement. But the agreement we reach here between the two of us is below the minimum wage agreed at the council level. How binding in terms of this, will I be able to exercise the right with this agreement I have with my union and ignore what the industry says?
Well, the simple... I just need to be informed. If in a factory there are workers who are not unionized, they don't even have an association. How do we go about when it comes to negotiations, bargaining, whatever? How do we go about it? They don't want to be unionized. They don't even want to form an association. How do they facilitate or address their grievances?
If workers are not unionized, they can't bargain, they can only beg. Mm. And that now depends on as people who work there, you need to believe strongly in the universal goodness of humankind. This person will be kind-hearted enough to sympathize with us. But I think that is where loss comes in. That we sit in this as, and these things are not just some sight, they are not some sight. There's a lot of work that went into doing the research to determine how much a person needs to live, what is the cost of living, what's the poverty that I'm lying. There are a lot of studies that are done into that. But you can't, as an individual, say, because I've agreed to with you, Mekona, and you've got no, you don't even have any knowledge of rights and whatever. You've got lots of illiterate workers who've never been to school. So what they know is that they just need a job, and as long as they get a salary, that's fine. But the law says you cannot, you can't just do as you wish. One day somebody is going to tell them that you are being exploited, that people in the same area of your work are earning 3 times what you are earning here, and you are going to be in trouble. That's just a comment. I don't know whether it's a question or whatever, but yeah, over to you.
Tom says, I can deal first, have a first stab at these 3 questions. The 30-day period, could it be stronger? It could be stronger. It could say, there could be a separate provision saying, if an agreement is extended, then the bargaining council must determine any exemption application in 30 days, failing which the extension is not valid. It could say that. It doesn't say that at the moment. The idea is that it's amending that what the minister must take into account in deciding whether to extend it. So the minister must sit and be satisfied that that's what's going to happen. Otherwise, she mustn't extend the agreement at all. But it doesn't go further and deal with, if she's satisfied and does that, does the bargaining council then have some legal duty? I mean, it must have a legal, internally, a provision to say we'll only take 30 days. But what is the consequence if the bargaining council then doesn't and the application gets stuck or something like that? At the moment, the Act doesn't regulate that. So that's a...
I presume you would then deal with it in terms of dispute resolution processes within the bargaining council.
The Pofara example, the general, if the agreement has been extended in that industry, CIFSA and the business in Pofara is in that industry, then the industry agreement takes preference and won't. You would have to apply for your plant level agreement. You'd have to apply for exemption from the industry arrangements at plant level. And that's why the Pofara employers that you're talking about are joining employers' organizations to try and attack these industry arrangements, because they say, hey, we want to engage at plant level. But the truth is they will give up to the industry level. The industry level takes precedence unless you get an exemption under this procedure in the bargaining council. Before I deal with that point, Tim, of course, you have.
Just to explain one area, on this area of 30 days, the thinking in the department is that when the minister considers the application to extend the agreement, we will have to ask the bargaining council to give us its record that shows how many applications for exemption they received, when did they receive those applications, and when did they take the decision, whether they comply with 30 days in deciding on those. And as part of the package that we sent to the minister, we say to the minister, this bargaining council has complied with section 4 and so on, the clock that is 30 days, therefore the minister should be able to use her discretion in extending. That's how we think we will factor it into whether the minister extends the agreement on the basis of his compliance with all the provisions of that.
Thanks. And then the third point on the non-unionized environment, comments of the chair are on point. The basic structure of the labor laws, LRA, and Basic Conditions of Employment Act, which you're looking at, is that the law will set what are typically called minimum standards or thresholds. For organizational rights, the law will say anybody who at least has certain basic levels of representation has a legal right to representation, and everything more than that you want is left to bargaining. So the law doesn't say you must get a telephone and a fax machine and an office and or anything like that. Those matters are left. The Act gives you a basic threshold of organizational rights, which is supposed to be the platform from which you then launch your collective bargaining as a trade union. And the same with the bargaining council conditions and the conditions of sectoral determinations in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act supposed to set, theoretically sets, the minimum standards that people must adhere to in the industry, and then trade union through unionization, through collective bargaining, you organize and get better standards if you're able to organize. And if you're non-unionized, and there is no mechanism in the labor law for you to improve your standards except by going individually to the employer and saying, hey, I mean, you can actually have a group, an informal group, a non-unionized informal group where you meet in an imbezo with the employer and say, we want to get another 10%. I mean, you can do that. But you don't have organizational rights unless the employer agrees to them. You don't have access to the labor laws protection. You're just relying then on the goodwill of the enterprise. Is that done?
Yeah. Can I just add 2 points and then I think we should move on from this because there's other controversial areas. The one is that in determining whether a bargaining council is sufficiently representative, the minister is going to have to take into account specifically the nature of the employees within the sector. In other words, if there are large-scale fixed-term contracts, part-time employees, temporary employment services-type employees, who are generally more difficult to organize and unionize, those things have to be taken into account. The other point that I just wanted to add in from what Chris is saying is that the exemptions area, I know is quite controversial, but there's been quite a lot of studies done by particularly people at the UCT on bargaining council exemptions and the bargaining structures in relation to small businesses. And in fact, a lot of their findings are quite... they don't kind of support the popular notion that small businesses are not in bargaining councils, and a lot of the noise that's in the press around those kinds of things. They also support a lot of the exemptions are quickly done, or done quite quickly, in a lot of the bargaining councils. But there are bargaining councils that are lagging. So there's a differentiation between sectors in relation to those kinds of areas. And there are figures available in relation to the number of exemption applications that are actually brought, number granted, and the figures that I hear are around between 80% and 90% are granted in certain of those bargaining councils. So there's differentiation between sectors. You can't have a blanket position in relation to those kinds of things. Let's then move on, and I'm just going to go quickly through the other areas. Amendment to Section 49 is about a certificate specifying the level of representativeness of a bargaining council. The Registrar of Labour Relations and the Department of Labour does that, and that should be used to determine a whole range of things besides Section 32 extension. And then there's an amendment to Section 51 saying that bargaining councils can charge and impose a levy for their dispute resolution services, very much like the CCMA, and I think that's been welcomed by everyone on the basis that many bargaining councils find it very difficult to fund their dispute resolution processes, and they need to find alternative sources of information. So I think those are less controversial unless anyone has major issue on them. The next area is the amendments to Chapter 4 of the LRA, which is dealing with strikes and lockouts and picketing, and we'll come to the question of the mall in this process, as was asked by Andre earlier. Now, this is an area that has generated a significant amount of controversy in the negotiations, and so I'll ask Mokalipi and Chris to listen very carefully to what I say and correct anything that I may not reflecting very carefully. The amendments in F are to introduce a requirement that before a trade union may embark upon a strike action, or before an employer's organization may embark upon a lockout, it must ballot its members. Now, you recall that was a requirement of trade unions under the 1956 Act.
And it led to a significant number of very technical interdicts of stocks. And the most famous one was the NUMSA industry strike, I think 1991 or 1992, which was interdicted on the basis that the ballot had been improperly done, and it caused a tremendous amount of controversy within the labor relations dispensation. And the view that was really taken in the 1995 Act was to say that balloting of members is an internal trade union matter. It's not a matter that should be a predetermine your ability to go out on strike. And therefore, a requirement for balloting was to be placed in every constitution of the trade union. And you couldn't interdict a strike because there had been no ballots. There's not many lockouts along these lines by employers' organizations, so some less controversy on one side. And that was the view that was taken in the 1995 Act. The amendment has sought to put this requirement of the ballot back in. And the reason advanced by those that support this view is that what we have seen is an unacceptable number of unprotected industrial, unprotected strikes, including strikes in essential services, and in particular, a substantial amount of unlawful acts and violence and intimidation associated with strikes. And they've pointed to things like the security guard strike, which led to a number of people being killed, some of the industry strikes in the metal engineering area, and to a lesser extent, the tossing of bins and rubbish and those types of things with local government strikes. I'm just adding that in because Adrian was sitting there. Give it a lighter moment. So, on essence, what has been put forward is that if there is a requirement for a ballot, that there will then be ballots, there will be, if there's a majority that supports it, then the strike will happen, and hopefully because there has been this process of a ballot, there will be less unprotected strikes and less violence associated with these strikes, because it will be sure that there's now a majority supporting the strike rather than the potential for only a minority supporting the strike and coercing other people to support the strike. So, but in order to deal with the issue of we don't want a technical objections to strikes that simply undermine the process of collective bargaining and strikes, what has been put in place is a certificate of compliance issued by the commission, a bargaining council, or an accredited private agency that says, okay, you have conducted a ballot, majority has supported it, fine, you can go out and strike, kind of like it. So the CCMA, for example, would supervise or oversee the process of the balloting and issue a certificate, and then that would be the end of the process in order to try and get rid of technical objections in relation to that. I might say that the requirement of the ballot has been put forward by government and debated at length at NEDLAC. To a large extent, these views have been supported by business, but there has been a very, very strong opposition from the by Labour in relation to the introduction of the ballot. And in essence, if I am reflecting their views correctly, what they are saying is that the ballot, there has been no real analysis of the issues associated with violence and strikes, and that there is no guarantee that balloting will in fact reduce the number of unprotected strikes. It might in fact increase the number of unprotected strikes rather than decrease it. And there has to be a more sober and a more comprehensive look
at the question of violence associated with strikes, to look at ways to reduce that violence, and that despite the certificates being issued by the Commission, the Bargaining Council, and accredited private agency, there is still the potential for technical objections to strikes, which will simply increase unprotected strikes, and I think they're worried about the costs associated with these agencies and bargaining councils and commissions having to deal with these ballots. So that's some of the arguments that have been put forward, but that has been introduced. And then the other key issue is the issue with regard to picketing.
I just want to know that with regard to this balloting, if Cathartic calls a strike, for instance, a national strike against a specific thing like toll roads or whatever, do they have to then get every single Cathartic affiliate to do a ballot then before we go on that one lane or
no, that would be a protest action in terms of Section 77. We are here talking about a strike against an employer for terms and conditions of employment or wages or those kinds of things.
So the DA won't need any permission to buy
that. The DA won't need any money.
Yeah.
That's not a strike.
Basically, what you are saying is, will there be accredited private agencies? Will the Act demand that private agencies be accredited by the department in order for them to be able to conduct this ballot? Because it's going to be a very interesting industry. It's going to be an industry on its own.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes to that. It would be the CCMA, a bargaining council, or an accredited agency. And that's the structure at the moment for all LRA dispute resolution, that you're accredited, in fact, by the CCMA, because the assumption is that there are agencies. Tukiso is the most well-known one in the labour field, which is an accredited agency.
No, it's not.
There's no accreditation.
That's my interest, because when you see you talk about accredited private agencies, I wanted to know more about this.
Want to register?
Yeah, you know, an employee.
Yeah,
so. You get surprised.
Just quickly, just to add one thing to what Anton says, the Act actually does, the amendments do distinguish between your internal union constitution balloting requirements, which are still not going to be relevant. An employer can't challenge the internal union process. This is the idea what's been introduced is a separate basic statutory requirement that there must have been a vote supported by a majority, period. So the old arguments about whether people were, you know, present or whether clause 3.1 of the constitution was complied with, did they get enough notice, etc., are not, that is still the section would still be there, which is the failure by union to comply with the provision of its own constitution is still not a basis for interdicting a strike. Instead, the requirement is the statutory requirement, and then the CCMA certificate would confirm that has been complied with. That was the structure of it, as Anton has said.
I think
you explained it now, because you are taking it from the current labor legislation. Now, am I correct to say the amendment now off biology as a result of the discussions at NEDVAC is to say, irrespective of there's a union that is in majority in an enterprise, through processes of bargaining, reach a deadlock, all those things, if it wants to go to strike, so everybody in the bargaining unit, which is represented in that in those negotiations, has to ballot, to be part of the ballot, irrespective whether they are members of the trade union or not. Because I'm raising this because if then it will be to say, take the strike of 1992, it was not members of a trade union balloting in the offices of the trade union, or even in the establishment. It was everybody that was balloting, even non-members of the trade union. So I'm saying, if then the amendment seeks to include even non-members in the balloting process, that will mean now you are saying there will be nobody who says, I don't have to go to strike because the majority has decided. Because in the current setup, it's the union that takes a decision from its constituents, from its members. So can you clarify me on that? Whether is that balloting process now, which exists in the constitutions of trade unions, now when it comes to bargaining matters, it has to include even non-members?
I'll clarify, it says only trade union members will be balloted. But it does raise, of course, the one difficulty, which I think we only became alive to after the draft was done, which is if non-union members want to go out on strike, how do they ballot if they're not in a trade union? So it does raise that difficulty. But certainly you can't have a situation where it would be a balloting of non-union members. It must be a ballot of, if NUMSA is calling the strike, it could only be NUMSA members that are required to be balloted. Okay, but they could, of course, call on non-NUMSA members to also go out on the strike in support of it. But that wouldn't mean they have to be balloted.
Okay,
But non-union members can participate in the strike once the union members have balloted in favor of a strike. So they will be protected.
Yes.
There's no amendment. That's the noise it is at the moment anyway. So there's no amendment.
Okay, let's move on to the question of ticketing. And again, this is an important area with regard to conduct associated with strikes and lockouts. This is an area, again, of controversy. Of less controversy, if I can put it that way. Basically, what the situation is, and I'll deal with the mall example first, that's an amendment to Section 69. Essentially, what the LRA promotes is a situation where the trade union and the employer would go and get a collective agreement on picketing rules. And the advice always has been to employers and trade unions to go and get that agreement, so that when there is a strike, you know where you can picket, where you can't picket, where you have access to toilets, where you don't have access to toilets, who your marshals are, all those kinds of things. And if you get a picketing rules, you may be able to picket on the premises or only off the premises. You know, those kinds of things are discussed in those kinds of picketing rules. And they're very important because, as you can imagine, on the picket line, it's a very emotional place. I mean, it's where you
where you're saying to the other people, don't go out on strike, you try to persuade them, and emotions arrive. And if you have drink thrown into the middle of that, then things can get out of hand. And so you want to have as much control over those processes as possible. One of the difficulties that has arisen is in areas where you have a third party that is in fact the landlord of the premises of the employer. And that's thrown up the issue of, for example, malls. So you've got a shopping centre mall, or it might be another type of business park or something like that. Now, can you picket on those premises that are not the employer's premises, but they're not publicly owned? Well, they're public area in the sense that everyone can go into the mall, but they're owned by a private person. And you've got all those American cases that go one way or the other about picketing in those types of scenarios. So some American cases say, no, you can't, it's private property. And the other cases, they say, no, although it's private property, it's open to the entire public, therefore, you know, all those kinds of things. The answer that's been come up with here is a very much along the lines of organizational rights, is to say, picketing rules can be enforced against the third party, provided the third party can be involved in the process of determining the picketing rules. So you might have a scenario where at, what's the shopping mall around here? Canal Walk. You might be able to say, okay, Canal Walk owners and Spa and the union involved, maybe Sukarwu, come together and they come to an agreement around picketing rules, where picketers can stand, what entrances they can stand at, those kinds of things. And it would be enforceable against the mall as well as a third party. By involving them in the process, one hopes to regulate it more effectively. Obviously, if the mall doesn't like those kinds of things, they can then go to the CCMA and go through that process, and possibly they can even review it if needs be. But that's an attempt to try and resolve that problem. The other thing is, what happens if, and this is the second thing and probably more contentious, certainly from Labour's point of view, was what happens if there's a breach of the picketing rule? What can be done? Usually, at the moment, employers rush off to the Labour Court and get an interdict, that is what is done. But the amendments attempt to increase the Labour Court's powers. They may order compliance with the picketing rules, or they may even vary the terms of the picketing agreement or rules. They may even suspend the picket or strike in appropriate circumstances. And it might also suspend a lockout as well. Okay. So the powers are extended in those circumstances. And they can, yes, as Chris points out, the kind of quid pro quo that was put up for suspending a strike was to be able to suspend replacement labour being used for employers. So that's what's been put up in relation to picketing.
I've got a question. When it comes to picketing, what rights do farm workers have? Have their rights been allowed to sit on their farm? The farm's worth, because that's private property. So if that's been amended, is anything looking at that? The farm workers live and work where they work. They can picket there. They can't get people flat land.
No. Don't forget that the general rule applies to all workplaces. So the farm is a workplace. You're not allowed to picket on the workplace without the permission of the employer. However, that permission essentially can't be unreasonably withheld. And if it is, the CCMA can overrule that. And that applies to every workplace, including farmers.
It's just that they live where they work.
Yeah.
So it's not like
it's a human or a
complicated.
It does. But so that's the picketing scenario. Let me pause at that point and see if there's any questions or additions.
Thank you.
because there's no real controversy around the 48 hours. I don't think there's a controversy around that. It's sometimes complicated in secondary strikes, and it's sometimes complicated in notice to the state and what, where, who the people who are entitled to 7 days notice. There may be questions about that. I'm not aware of, I think that if there was the one issue that was controversial was whether, at some point, was whether a suspended strike, whether you have to give fresh notice of resuming a suspended strike. And the current authority is that you don't have to give notice of it, which is a slightly strange situation where a union can go on strike, stop it after a day, and then after that at any time hit the employer with strike action without notice on the same issue. If that could be going back to court, the only thing I could think of that's controversial about the notice, strike notice. But we're sorry we can't enlighten you on that. Sir.
Can I move on then to essential services, which was another aspect of the strikes and lockouts. Now, for some, I would love to, in another life, work out before a meeting what is going to be the controversial issue. And you would have thought this was not going to be the controversial issue, but it took absolute days and days and days of negotiations around essential services. And for what reason, I'm not quite sure, but it was a very long, drawn-out process, and Philippe is smiling because everyone couldn't believe that it was becoming so difficult. Essentially, what one has here is a situation where the Essential Services Committee is under the auspices of the CCMA. And it is by nature, a tripartite structure. So the chairperson was generally independent, and there was a business representative and a trade union representative, appointee, should I say, not representative, but appointee on the committee, and essential service determinations were made. And there's been a lot of criticism about the functioning of the committee. There's been a lot of criticism about the way in which its awards have been put out. In fact, it's not been very transparent over the years about the publishing of awards and those kinds of things. And we've also seen that in many areas, particularly in the public service, there has been a substantial amount of strike action in areas that are deemed or classified as essential services. In areas like nursing, even doctors at one point went out on strike, which is quite unbelievable. And in the local government area, there's a lot of areas that are essential, and the accusation that those people go out on strike without the right to go out on strike. The response, to a large extent, has been that a response from trade unions has been, well, the reason for that is because the employers don't really agree to minimum service agreements. And remember, a designation is made essential. It's usually a very broad designation, like the whole of Eskom is essential because it's a supply of electricity. And then the expectation is that the parties will conclude a minimum service agreement determining exactly who can go out on strike and who can't go out on strike, and then there will be an expression of the right to strike. Now, there's a lot of debate around these kinds of areas, but whether those responses or those accusations are correct or not, I'll leave it up to you to determine, but those are the kinds of points that have been made. So the amendments that have been put up are amendments that deal with, in particular, the composition of the Essential Services Committee and then its powers and functions. Now, a complicated thing has been put up in which the Essential Services Committee is now going to be there's going to be an independent chairperson who may be a senior commissioner and a deputy chairperson who has to be a senior commissioner of the CCMA.
And the reason for that is up to now we've had independent chairpersons generally taken from the bar, advocates from the bar, and their ability to dedicate time to this process had been questioned, particularly when they face a 15,000 rand brief, you know, from the state attorney to go and appear in the High Court as opposed to the 2,500 rand a day to appear at the Essential Services Committee. You understand why postponements at the Essential Services Committee office. I'm being a bit facetious, but you can hear what money does talk in those. So it's to put up an independent chair and a deputy chair, so that and that person has to be a senior commissioner, so that there's always someone to fulfill that role. And now it extends the Essential Services Committee to two government reps, two labour reps, and two business reps. So a tripartite structure. And the reason for that is, to a large extent, essential services are now about state services. The private sector areas have been really determined. But it's rather strange to have a business rep, private sector rep, representing or adjudicating on matters where it's a state service. And you really want someone from the state to be there. So that, I think, is accepted. However, and now I want you to jump to Section 70C, because this deals with the composition. What will happen is that a referral will come, or an investigation will come to the Essential Services Committee with these two chairs and two reps from each social partner, and they will then appoint a committee to hear, or not a committee, a panel to hear this matter. And the panel will be composed of, on the one hand, employer reps, and on the other hand, employee reps. And the employer reps will either be business reps or government reps. It will be government reps if it's a public service that is being considered, and it will be business reps if it's a private service that's being considered. Okay, so that's the one principle that's in it, so that you have the right kind of person hearing the matter. Okay, it's very difficult for the business rep who comes from, big kind of Anglo-American to understand social pensions and provision of pensions and immigration offices and, you know, those kinds of things. Then the committee may be composed of the panel may be composed of three reps or five reps. Three people or five people. If it's composed of three people, it will be the chair or the deputy chair or a senior commissioner from the CCMA. So there's your independent person, okay? And then it will be one person from the Essential Services Committee nominated by Labour, and one person from the Essential Services Committee, either from government or from a business, depending on the nature of the public service. Is everyone with me?
Yeah.
Okay. Or it can be a situation where the trade union at that point can say, we want to nominate Andre as our representative, because he's got special expertise, as our appointee, because we know that he's got special expertise in, I don't know what you have expertise in, Andre. But we think you've got expertise in that particular area, and therefore we're nominating you. And the employer or government rep could say, okay, I'm going to nominate Mr. X or Ms. X because we know that he or she's got expertise in those areas. The chairperson of the panel will determine all questions of law, including what is a matter of law and what is a matter of fact. The other two reps are there like assessors to assess the facts. Okay, very much like you have assessors in a criminal case. You know, they assess the facts, but they don't determine the law. The judge still determines the law.
very much like the old Labour Appeal Court in the 1956 Act. So that's the if it's a really big controversial matter like Eskom, you know, are we considering electricity? The Essential Services Committee might say, no, we want to actually extend this to 5 reps, and then it'll be 2-2 on both sides. They could be drawn from the Essential Services Committee or outside. Okay, so that's the composition. Now, that took about 3 days to negotiate in the lab. 3 days, probably an underestimation. The next thing, which is very important, is that the Essential Services Committee's powers will be extended to not only determining what is essential, but they can also determine what is a minimum service. All right? So they will say, okay, we think electricity, the provision of electricity, is an essential service. However, we know that everyone in Eskom is not essential. The gardeners are not essential. The canteen workers are not essential. The, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We're giving the parties an opportunity to go away and negotiate a minimum service agreement. If they can't do so, we'll determine it. Okay. Now, they will have the power to determine a minimum service agreement. That means, at the end of the day, they'll be able to say, okay, we are going to look at Eskom, and we're going to say these strata of employees are essential, they're not essential, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, the Supreme Court of Appeal at the moment in the Eskom matter against Norman Numsa has essentially come up with that policy view already on the basis of the present LRA as it is. They've found a clause to kind of argue that policy to it. So, in essence, as I understand it, these amendments don't go against the judicial thinking, certainly as it is reflected by the Supreme Court of Appeal in the Eskom matter at the moment. Because they are also saying, remember, in that situation, Eskom refused to enter into a minimum service agreement with Norman Numsa. And Norman Numsa referred, and I think Solidarity as well, but I'm not quite sure. Norman Numsa referred the matter to the CCMA as, because they're essential, this is a matter of mutual interest, we want an interest arbitration to determine a minimum service agreement. So if you, the ILO quite clearly specifies, if you can't strike, you must have the right to interest arbitration. Eskom took that matter on review to the Labour Court and won before Judge Besson, saying that you couldn't, the CCMA didn't have power to do that. Norman Numsa took that matter on appeal to the Labour Appeal Court and won. The Labour Appeal Court essentially favouring the view that if you can't strike, you must have the right to interest arbitration. Eskom then appealed that to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And the Supreme Court of Appeal has come up with the view that the CCMA can't determine that through interest arbitration, but the Essential Services Committee can through a particular section of the LRA. So they've essentially given effect to the LAC's view, but not, Eskom won the case, if I can put it to you in a bizarre kind of way. Huh? Yeah. So, in essence, what we have in these reflects the views of the Supreme Court of Appeal, at a policy level at least. Okay. And that's, there's one exception though, and this is a strange exception. It was mooted as a pro-labor scenario, but it's also to promote interest arbitration. So, if at the end of the day, the Essential Services Committee says, we designate electricity as essential, but we've now determined a minimum service agreement because the parties can't come to an agreement. But that minimum service agreement, the employees say, that minimum service agreement is so broad that we might as well have just had the broad designation. The employees can vote in favour of the broader designation, which means that they have to go to interest arbitration. And that is in order to promote interest arbitration. Okay, because it means at the end of the day there won't be strike action there, it will promote interest arbitration more broadly. I've tried to explain a very complicated process. I hope you understand it. But maybe we can get some clarification. And I don't know what when T is. 11. Okay, so maybe in the dying minutes of this.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've just got some questions of clarity. You used the Eskom example, but in the municipalities, there's obviously traffic cops, firemen.
Now, what happens if the Essential Service Committee can't agree? Do you know what I'm saying? If they're that, what happens if they can't agree? They, you know, when they have to impose what they think is the essential services. Because it could, especially the start of the farming. For instance, what is the point of going on strike if you're going to just all the services are just going to continue anyway? For instance, the municipality might say, well, the rubbish collection is an essential service due to the fact that without it, eventually, you could have disease, etc., etc. Whereas the union might say, no, no, rubbish collection is not essential, but we agree that firemen are all essential, for instance. And let's say, what happens if they don't agree? What happens if the Essential Services Committee doesn't agree?
Also, on the determination, labor is often well organized, but the public is the biggest loser if essential services are withheld, is not so well organized in terms of going to, you know, put a case forward. So my question is, what provision is there for those affected by the lack of services? Would there be, let's say the ESCOM senior officials feel, you know, we're not going to put a strong case forward. You know, we've got generators at home or whatever. But we as the public, we are the ones suffering when the electricity is cut, etc. Is there any provision in which the general public can also approach and ask for a determination in this regard or be informed in time that a service will be declared an essential service and that the public can make input into that?
May I just, Chair, and I think I'm going to deal with Adrian's question. Well, actually, this question I think Anton can deal with because it's a formal question about participation in essential service determinations. The question that you raised, Adrian, I want to be skeptical, but to me, I don't think that the problem of workers ignoring prohibitions on strike action in essential services is going to be solved by changing the composition or the proceedings or anything else to the Essential Services Committee, because you've just put your finger on it. The power of a strike depends on the ability of workers to stop the enterprise. That's why pilots have power. And that's why in local government, if the only thing you stop are street sweepers and the odd bit of garbage collection, the government doesn't feel the heat and the public are barely inconvenienced. What hurts the public and what hurts government is when you stop the fire services and the ambulances and the things that are critical to government business. Now, I just want to contextualize this in different jurisdictions. The way that international standards are that firemen can't go on strike. And they've got a fundamental right to strike, and that's a problem in the Constitution. It's limited by a law of general application which prohibits it. And internationally, that's recognized as being necessary. And so when you're a fireman, you can't go on strike. You do have a different remedy. And that remedy is that you can ask an arbitrator to impose a wage increase through interest arbitration. So that's what the Labor Relations Act has got. It says if you can't strike because you're a fireman, You can go for an arbitration on something that you can't normally do. You can't normally go and impose a wage increase on employee arbitration, but essential service workers can. The real problem that we've got, so if you take another example from local government, take a hospital. What's the value of getting, for workers, of getting the key parts of the hospital to carry on functioning during a strike so that those workers who don't really disrupt the hospital's operations at all go on strike, forfeit their wages, and the employer, if it's the hospital, is the employer, doesn't feel any pain. The reason why it's precluded, though, of course, is because members of the public are going to die in the queue if the hospital is disrupted severely. So the law says, and internationally says, disputes in those hospitals must go to interest arbitration, and the arbitrators impose conditions, even if employers would never agree to it in collective bargaining. They listen to all the arguments. And in other jurisdictions, Canada's a good comparison. We've got good stats from Canada because one of South Africa's top labor lawyers is a trade union lawyer called Chris Albertine. Franz Chenel's Albertine attorney is now one of the top interest arbitrators in Canada. The real point is that you need bargaining units that separate out firemen and hospital workers and ambulancemen, where so that their terms and conditions don't depend on the outcome of negotiations for people who are not in essential services. Because otherwise, you've got a single wage dispute, and all the people who've got the most power aren't allowed to go on strike, and the people with the least power are allowed to go on strike, and the people with the most power can't then go to wage arbitration either, because you've got a single dispute and you're trying to use power instead of interest arbitration. So to my mind, I think that if this committee wants to really fix up essential services, unless they grapple, well, any need like that to grapple with it. But having said that, as to improving the functioning of the essential services committee, I've no doubt these provisions, I'm not disputing these, I think these provisions will improve the functioning of the essential service committee, make it more representative, and I'll let Anton deal with the question of how the public could be involved. I just don't think that my own view is that it's not going to solve the central problem, which is really a bargaining unit problem.
Thank you. Any other questions?
The issue that Andre has raised, of course, if there is a minimum service agreement, it has to be ratified by the Essential Services Committee, which the reason why there has to be a ratification of the collective agreement is because the Essential Services Committee is charged with looking after the interests of the public. That's the first thing. So a minimum service agreement can't just be agreed to and then it's implemented. It is of no force and effect until it is ratified by the Essential Services Committee. And in fact, there have been numerous minimum service agreements that have been drawn up between employers and trade unions, particularly at local government level, that have not been ratified. Mainly because they just were not clear. But if you look at the powers and functions of the committee, I'm just looking with the provision. It's quite clear that any person can refer a matter to the Essential Services Committee. It has to investigate a matter if the bargaining council does that, but any person can. I'm just looking for the provision. I can't. So the powers and functions of the committee in 70B are to monitor implementation, promote, determine, decide. Oh, there it is, 70B1D. So the powers and functions of the essential service are to decide on its own initiative or at the request of any interested party whether to institute investigations as to whether or not the whole or part of any service is an essential service. So you have to be an interested party. You can't just be, some person who has some ideological view and wants to put it in front of the committee. You have to be a person who would be affected by a service not being ready. But you have to say you have to be an interested party.
Thank you.
the end of it.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've just got one more point on this. Differences within, for instance, municipalities. So what you're saying is essentially what the new legislation says is that the essential services panel will come up with, the sweepers can go on strike, but the firemen and the essential services within the municipal go to the arbitration and then an award is given to them. Now, is that award given to them? Do you know what I'm saying? It sounds as if you're splitting the workforce now between the people that are protected for the special thing. They have to work. They can't go on strike. Fair enough. But they can go and get an award from an arbitrator that might be completely different to the award that Selga, their employer is giving to them. So fundamentally, you could split the workforce into two pieces, which would become problematic for those firemen after that, because the arbitrator only works when there's a strike on, but if there's another condition of employment, they have to go back to their union, which isn't representing them during the strike. So how does that work for those people?
Okay. This is an area of it's a very, very complex area, let me put it this way. I mean, if you look, for example, at the public service as a whole, you've got the PSCBC where they're negotiating wages. You've got within that group essential services people and non-essential services people. In the 1998 strike, public service strike, you had a strike and a referral to essential services committee. In relation, an interest arbitration in relation to wages. I think Sarah Christie was the arbitrator with the guy from Ratledge's. What do you say? So you always have that problem of how are those kinds of things determined. The one view that has been expressed in relation, and now there's no amendments to this, but this is the law as it is at the moment, is that if you have a minimum service agreement, then those that cannot strike can't refer their matter to interest arbitration. They must throw their lot in with the strikers. That's the one view. And it's a view held by some of the people in the drafting team. There is another view that they don't have to throw their lot in. Okay, but be that as it may, there's no amendment to that issue at the moment. That's a matter of interpretation. If they throw their lot in with the strikers, then the union has got to look at this minimum service agreement and say, if these guys can't go out on strike, and only these guys can go out on strike, have we got sufficient power to win our demands? If we haven't got sufficient power to win our demands, then we might as well refer the whole thing to interest arbitration in the beginning and not lose the wages, because obviously workers will lose their wages in that process. So that's the power issue that's always the union has to consider. I think that there is a general view that more and more we should be promoting interest arbitration in these kinds of areas. At the moment, it is not well used in South Africa, interest arbitration. There is now, if you look at the Canadian type of precedents, there used to be a view that, in fact, unions got more out of interest arbitration than collective bargaining. But now it seems as though the research, because there's always this research happening in North America about, do you get more from interest arbitration or from bargaining? It's pretty much 50-50 at this point. That's the latest research. All right, that's essential services. I suggest we have some tea. sure.
You mentioned that some of these service agreements that have been negotiated have not been ratified. And you briefly mentioned the reason for that. Can you just elaborate why is that the case and how does it impact the current position of South Africa regarding strikes and looking after the interests of essential services?
I think the difficulty is that the parties, both employers and trade unions, find it very difficult to conclude minimum service agreements because they are very, very detailed agreements. And the parties at this point have tried to negotiate them at kind of national level. So you've had this kind of attempted negotiations at the PSCBC level to negotiate minimum service agreements. And I don't think you can do that there. So they've kind of said, well, let's agree on a percentage. You know, if 60% can go out on strike, 40% must remain. Or 70-30. But that you can't negotiate a minimum service agreement like that because you, Anton, need to know if you're working in the Department of Social Development, can you go out on strike? So you've got to actually determine it by category of employees and those kinds of things. So you can't just have something. That was the problem with, there was a minimum service agreement at Eskom. And what happened is it resulted in huge disputes between the employer and the trade union as to who could go out on strike or not. Because it wasn't a good agreement in the sense that it clearly defined who could go out on strike and who couldn't. So you have to do that at plant level or at business level, operation level. You have to go to that hospital and at that hospital say, those people can go out on strike, those people can't. You know, it's a very complex process. And I think the unions and employers have found it very difficult to negotiate those types of agreements. And I think the reason why they haven't, some of those haven't been ratified is for precisely that reason, that they have not identified clearly who can go out on strike and who can't. So come a strike, everyone's going to argue, no, of course I can go out and strike. And you're going to have this...
I'm in the 40%.
I'm in the 40%, whereas you don't know.
Yeah.
You know. So I think that's been part of the problem. In relation to those. Yeah, you need to say, okay, of the health workers who can go out on strike, doctors, can they go out on strike? No, they can't. Nurses, can they go out on strike? Well, nurse assistants, can they go out on strike? You have to go category by category. But you might also, in those categories, say, of the nurse assistants, we only need 40%. Okay, then who's not going to go out on strike of those 40%? The other thing that is very, very complex in the scenario is the question of no work, no pay. Because if the workers that are on strike are not getting paid, and generally they don't get paid if they are out on strike, but the workers that are working are being paid, you have a major conflict between those two categories of workers. And so how do you regulate no work, no pay in that context? Do the minimum service workers who are working not receive pay as well? What happens to their pay? Does it get put into a strike fund? These are the kinds of things that minimum service agreements in Canada and those kinds of places regulate those issues. So they don't get paid. That money gets paid and distributed to everyone. Now those are complex issues to deal with.
This is the longest 5 minutes left.
I'll move through quickly. One thing I forgot to mention under the Essential Service Committee has been an issue about state officials acting in the name of the state, exercising the authority of the state. They don't fall strictly into the definition of essential services, but internationally have, in many countries, been recognized as people may be
be deemed essential. We're talking here about immigration officers, customs officials, and administrators of justice. The proposal is that they can be deemed essential provided there is a minimum service agreement that is put in place, which is the general international trend. It has been something that has been discussed and been of some controversy in the case around that. That would be determined by the Essential Services Committee, but it would usually be people who are hearing people for bail applications, magistrates, those types of people. But that category would be clearly defined by the Essential Services Committee. The draft doesn't go to the extent of actually doing that itself.
My question is, if the public feels that they can't be represented well enough for the outcome, you know, they can't agree with the outcome, what's the way of appealing?
There's no appeal on the Essential Services Committee. One can review it in the Labor Court. Alternatively, you can request the Essential Services Committee to investigate the matter again. They're quite at liberty to reopen an investigation and they have done so in certain circumstances. All right, I'm going to move on. And I'm just going to briefly mention some of the areas because I want to get to non-standard employment, which I think is the key area of controversy. Not controversy, but of interest. There are a number of other provisions that have been added, extending the powers of the CCMA and dealing with issues like rescissions, enforcing awards, and reviews. The CCMA has been empowered to assist lower-paid employees with service and filing and those kinds of things. Lots of employees, non-unionized employees who don't have assistance, unable to serve their process on their employer, the CCMA is empowered to assist them with that process. And I think that's been put up in Section 115. And then the other issue, which is a very, very big issue for the labour market, is the question of the enforcement of awards. And we've heard some very disturbing figures in some of the bargaining councils where and the CCMA, where a lot of awards are made against employers and they just simply ignore them. And very little gets done. Or it gets put into the review, the channel that puts it into reviews, and it just gets lost in the judicial process. And it's a real problem. So there have been some
I'll try and use my shop tube voice. The requirement that original awards have to go to the Labor Court to be certified has been removed, and when enforcing awards, two things have been done. First of all, the need for the a writ issued by the Labor Court has been removed. Second of all, the need to have an arbitration award made in order of court before contempt proceedings has been removed. Now, what happens is that if you get a reinstatement award and you reinstate that employee and the employer doesn't do it, what do? Well, you go, the normal course is to go contempt proceedings. But because of a lacuna in the Act, the court has said, well, you first have to make this an arbitration award in order of court before before you can be in contempt of court, because you can't be in contempt of an award. So we said, well, consider the award to be an order of court, deemed, so that we don't have to go through two processes. The application to make an arbitration award an order of court can take 6 months. And then the third thing is that the enforcement of awards to pay money will occur since the rules of the magistrate's court. A lot of workers get a reinstatement award or an award in money, and then they want to send the sheriff round to say, you know, get my money or attach some goods, as is normally the case in any commercial type of situation. And the sheriff says, well, you've got an award for 2,000 rand, but I require so much deposit before I will attempt to get the money from the employer, and the indigent or unemployed worker doesn't have that money. So I attempt to make it costly and more efficient for those types of work. Then rescinding arbitration awards before the commission just extended the ground to include the common law grounds, which is to say that you might have an award. An employer has an award against it, but the award was granted without the employer being there because he was on his way and he broke his leg and couldn't attend. Well, you should, on good cause, try and be able to rescind that award. Now, there's a whole range of controversy, legal, technical arguments about that, so we just cut through it and said, on good cause, show you can rescind the award. The same would apply for an employee in those differences. Then reviews are taking place. I think the Dutch president informed us it was about 80% of the caseload of the labor court was reviewed. That doesn't mean actually that every case is taken on review, but of those that are taken on review, about 80% of the labor court thing. Now, what happens often is that reviews get taken and then nothing is done, and for years it just sits in the labor court process, and of course nothing gets enforced in that area. And in order to attempt to streamline those scenarios, particular things have been put up. Now, of course, a review doesn't suspend an award. It's not an appeal. An appeal usually suspends a court order, but a review doesn't. So what happens is you then have to say, no, well, despite the review, I want to execute on the award. And then the employer, because generally the employer that's reviewing will bring an application to stay the execution of the award pending the review. And there's a whole costly process associated with that. So what has been suggested is that the labor court has the power to suspend the operation of an arbitration award if security is provided to the applicant. And in that case, the applicant would be an employee, and it would be, in the case of reinstatement, a certain amount of the employee's wages, or the actual award itself, or the court has the discretion to make it allowed. And there's a requirement that all reviews must be set down within 6 months. And if you don't set it down within 6 months, you've got to ask for condemnation from the court for why you haven't done it within 6 months. What happens is the review gets instituted, you have to wait for the record, and you just don't get the record together as the reviewing party. So now it's very similar to appeals. When you appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeals, you've got to prosecute your appeal within 60 days. If you don't do it within 60 days, put the record in 60 days, you have to get permission for going beyond the 60 days from the court. So we're just introducing a very similar provision in relation to that. And then there's another scenario, is that a review application interrupts the running of prescription. An arbitration award is subject to the Prescription Act. So if you don't execute on that award within 3 years, you have But what happens is a party reviews it, and it can take up to 3 years to resolve the review. By the time you resolve the review, it's left. So, because the review doesn't generally interrupt prescription, there's a provision of test now does interrupt prescription. So that's an attempt to try and streamline reviews. The majority of reviews are by the employer, but that's not to say that they aren't reviews by employees at all. Then there are requirements that the commission must resolve a dispute, an unfair dismissal dispute, even if a private dispute agency has been appointed. There has been a tendency amongst some parties to include a private dispute, private arbitration clause in a contract of employment and to require the employee to pay the arbitrator, the private arbitrator. Now, for a lot of paid employees, that's very unfair. So, in the case of lower paid employees, there's a threshold. If the employee is required to pay for that private arbitrator, the DTMA is allowed to assume jurisdiction. And then, Section 150 was introduced. Section 150 deals with strikes, particularly strikes where there's a major public interest. So, for example, a major security strike or a major strike in local government or whatever industry. Up to now, the CCMA director has not been able to intervene to reconvene conciliation proceedings except by consent of the party. We're saying, these amendments are saying, the CCMA director can call the parties to a conciliation, doesn't have to have the parties' consent to try and get them to get to an agreement. That doesn't affect the right to strike or the right to lock. So that just gives more power to the CCMA director to do so, and obviously put pressure on those parties to try and come to a quicker deal. Then there are provisions relating to the tenure of labour court judges, to make them on par with High Court judges and to be remunerated on the same basis, and also to allow for Labour Court judges to act as Labour Appeal Court judges. That's 154 and 156. And then 158 deals with the review, and it also says that what has been a tendency amongst litigants who love to litigate and keep things delayed for a long time is you go to a CCMA, you raise a point in limine, preliminary point, you lose on that preliminary point, then you review that preliminary point, then you go back to the arbitration, then you take another match, then you review the preliminary point. And so you can delay things forever and ever. The normal scenario is that you cannot review something until the matter is complete. That's the normal rule in most courts. And so what's been introduced is that rule. But in exceptional circumstances, you can review if it would make sense or concern in the interest of justice. So that's been introduced. There's also an introduction in 159 about the Rules Board. There's been some controversy in the Labour Court that the Rules Board hasn't met for many, many, many moons, and it needs to update its rules, so there's an incentive for them now to meet. And there's an introduction in 161 about Labour Consultants. What has happened is that Labour Consultants are appearing in the Labour Court. What they do is they form a Labour Consultancy. They join the employer's organization of the employer, and they then appear as an official of the employer's organization, but they then charge a normal consultancy type, attorney type fee to the employer, and they are essentially labor consultants masquerading. I mean, they are employer organization officials masquerading as lawyers and labor consultants. So it's just to try and prevent that kind of thing happening in the labor court. So you can be an employer official, employer organization official, but then you can't charge a fee as a labor consultant would. There's 168 is the labor court judges can be appointed to act in the labor appeal court, which is a normal kind of situation in the high court. So that's not any great consultant. 186 is a situation where the definition of dismissal has been extended to include a situation where, at the moment, if you have a reasonable expectation of your fixed-term contract being renewed and it's not renewed, then you can say that that constitutes a dismissal. There's obviously a loophole where you have a reasonable expectation and indefinite contract, but not a non-fixed-term contract, well, then it's not within the definition of dismissal. So we've just added in a definition that deals with that loophole.
Chair, I don't know if you can interrupt my colleague, but we're moving on to the unfair dismissal section, which is slightly different then. Can I, just before we conclude on the improved efficiency of the Commission and the Labour Court. I thought it was appropriate to just draw attention to the fact that if there's one area where there's the most solid consensus between the parties in NEDLAC, it's the changes to the Labour Court's function specifically, and the tenure of Labour Court judges and the changes that are in sections 150 onwards. I'm not showing up 150, 151 actually. So from page 15, that amendment page 151, it starts to deal with the Labour Court judges and the standing of the Labour Court. There's some quite technical reasons why there are problems with the structure at the moment. So, for example, the Labour Appeal Court has to second in judges from the High Court to sit in Labour Appeal Court matters and can't get Labour Court judges to act as Labour Appeal Court judges when it needs a Labour Appeal Court judge. So, and that is causing, those kinds of things are causing, not all the parties agree that these provisions from 151 to 168, I think it's 170 actually, which is also about resignation and judges remuneration, are formal amendments to the functioning of the Labour Court that are important and could even be seen as completely discreet because they're not about, you know, labour management relations. They're really about the functioning of the Labour Court.
Can I just, in terms of this reasonable expectation that a fixed-term contract will be renewed, what I've seen is that employers normally include a clause in there and say, you know, I, the employer, admits or, you know, agrees that there can be no reasonable expectation for this to be, when actually, you know, it's not really the case. Coming from my background, I've seen it at technical colleges or FET colleges, at school governing bodies and so on. They appoint these educators or college lecturers year after year because you need somebody to do electrical engineering 101 or whatever. And yet that clause is there and those people get reappointed year after year. Now, those are the sort of things that I think in this review of the legislation we want to address. But is this enough to address that kind of problem, or do we need something else? Should it not be put stronger? If you could just comment on that, please.
Well, being the Labour representative, I always want something stronger, but no, I'm joking. I think the law as it stands, as it has been interpreted by the Labour Appeal Court in relation to these matters, is that a clause of that nature in a contract is strongly indicative of the fact that there is no reasonable expectation. But it is not the only factor that they would take into account. And there would be a whole range of factors that they would take into account. I think to do with the last case was a sporting case, of the rugby players who had that clause in the Labour Appeal Court, in the Rugby Players Association case, where they had that clause for a fixed term contract to be renewed. And they dismissed that application on the basis that that clause was in the contract, and there wasn't sufficient evidence outside of that to indicate a reasonable expectation, which indicates to me that they don't only look at the clause. It's not definitive, in other words.
In law, a clause like that couldn't oust a fair labour practice right. You couldn't say, for example, you agree that if this contract ends, you'll be fairly, it'll be this. So there's always going to be the right to scrutinise whether the clause did end properly, whether the contract did end properly, and so on. Just to make a response to your point, repeat rollovers often create expectations, and so employers are likely to lose their cases if they dispute that repeat rollovers have become more trend, except for the fact that there are circumstances when it's justified. So sometimes a lecturer's position is funded by an external donor, and you can only give it each time for the period of the donation, or something like that. So that's why it's difficult to legislate for every situation in the Act. But at the moment, people have to content themselves with showing that because of prior conduct, they expected that this situation would continue.
This clause 186 must also be read in the context of the new clause of being a fixed term contract, which I will come to. The section 187 amendment is an amendment that the government has expressed some disquiet about. It arises essentially out of two cases, NUMSA versus Fried Metal and Chemical Workers Industrial Union versus Algorax. It essentially says that if you want to compel a worker to accept new terms and conditions of employment or a matter of mutual interest, you can't dismiss for that purpose. If you dismiss for that purpose, it is automatically undertaken. What happened is that we have a clause in section 187.1c. It was interpreted in NUMSA versus Fried Metal by the Labour Appeal Court and by the Supreme Court of Appeal to mean essentially that you couldn't do the old lockout dismissal. The old lockout dismissal was something that happened in under the 1956 Act. And what happened is that employers would lock you out and then they would dismiss you. But if you accepted their demand, they would reinstate. It was called a lockout dismissal. And the Labour Appeal Court, the Supreme Court of Appeal, said in Nonsense of Fried Metal, that's what 187.1c was trying to do. It was trying to dismiss as prevent lockout dismissal. So, you could dismiss if you don't accept the new terms and conditions of employment. But as soon as you offered to rehire them, then it was a problem. Now, in NUMSA versus Fried Metal, it was really an interdict of a situation where you had a shift pattern. The employer wanted to impose a new shift pattern, new terms and conditions relating to beginning and ending of shift. And the workers didn't want to do that, and they said it was a collective bargaining issue, and the employer said, no, I'm retrenching you, and the union took the employer to court saying, you're attempting to compel a demand relating to terms and conditions of employment, and you're threatening dismissal, that automatically unfair. The Labour Court agreed, the LAC and the Supreme Court of Appeal disagreed. The situation was the other way around in Algorax. What happened there is that the union had been quite intransigent, and the employer had gone through a process of substantial negotiations with the union. And eventually said, no, we can't take it anymore, we are dismissing. But if you do accept our terms and conditions, we'll reinstate you. And the employer, who had actually seemed to be a very reasonable employer, was on the Section 187 C scenario, because it had implemented what was seen as a lockdown dismissal, even though most practitioners feel that they had gone through a very reasonable process. So the amendment attempts to deal with that by saying that it is automatically unfair to dismiss someone in order to compel anyone. That is the area for collective bargaining. Obviously, if you need to reach operational requirements, that is still a possibility, but you have to see, you have to determine whether you are infringing that area. The amendment says that this is an attempt to give effect to the intention of the provision as enacted in 1995. Okay. I don't know, do you want to comment on that?
I think it's a very difficult area of contestation between employers and employees, where the employer wants to make structural changes to the enterprise, but in the classic case, both five metals and alterations concern changes to the shift system. So the employer wants to change the shift system and the employees don't agree to it. Can employers ultimately retrench workers who won't work the shift system that they say they need for their business? That's at the heart of this discussion. Business has not agreed to this change, and they strongly feel that this is an attempt to that this might prevent legitimate business restructuring, or be attempted to use to prevent a legitimate business restructuring. Workers, employer, I think Labour supports this change because they say it's a more appropriate description of what is, when employers can and can't use dismissal when they want to make workplace change. So it is an area, it's a complicated area of contestation. Inevitability, this case court has to go back up to the Supreme Court of Appeal or the Constitutional Court before we'll know whether employers and employees are happy with the balance that is drawn. It's never that comfortable. It's not really legislate because you want to create certainty. In this instance, the effect is going to be that we have to wait and see how the courts interpret it. And I think that's probably the main reason why business is unlikely.
Okay, then I'm going to keep on going in the interest of time and let people stop me. The next area, which is I'm going to skip the 188A. I don't think those are controversial amendments that the pre-dismissal arbitration pronounced or pre-dismissal inquiry. The next one is 188B, which I suppose is to a certain extent controversial. There has been reaction from Labour on it, and I think the business to a large extent is accepted and government accepted. And that is the dismissal of high-earning employees. And this is an attempt to try and create flexibility at the higher level, in particular senior executives. And essentially what happens is the notion is that senior executives generally have good bargaining power. They have notice clauses that are sometimes 9 months, 12 months, those kinds of things. 3 months, 6 months. And they pay exorbitant amounts of money. And then when it comes to the question of trying to dismiss them, it is extremely difficult and extremely
So, and there are also questions about when senior executives, for example, don't fit into the new culture of the firm that the firm is going to take. What is that? Misconduct? Is that poor performance? Is that operational requirements? How do you then change? Okay, so. You give a golden handshake. And that's generally what happens. Now, what this proposal seeks to do is to say it's deemed fair if you pay 3 months' notice. You don't have to have a fair hearing and have a fairly substantive reason, provided you pay 3 months' notice payment. And people then can be put into, or can be dismissed on that basis. Now, of course, they could negotiate greater than 3 months, and they generally do, okay? And then that would be deemed fair. And there's a transitional provision at the end to say that they can, it would apply only in 2 years' time to those already employed, so that they can get their affairs in order. Remembering that in a lot of foreign jurisdictions, these people are excluded from dismissal law, fair dismissal law. If you go, for example, to the United States or Canada, they're outside of bargaining units and they don't have those rights. And that's what has been put forward. Now, it is controversial from the point of view of where do you set the threshold. No threshold has been put into the Act as yet, but it would be determined by the minister with certain criteria. But people are bantering about, you know, we're talking about people earning in excess of $1 million a year.
Entry level for a director general,
yeah. Those types of scenarios. Now, the point here is that the objections that have been raised, I think, are mainly by unions who are organized at that level and or organized people that are like salesmen who earn, you know, not managers, but like salesmen and those investment bankers and, you know, those types of people who earn well above that threshold but are not managers and those kinds of things. But in general, what it is an attempt to do is to create labor market flexibility at that level where we often get consumed with litigation. I don't know if you want to add to it.
Maybe just two things. The one is that the cost or to a business enterprise of dispute resolution or resolving those conflicts or differences at the top level is generally very, very high. And for a long time, the government's been looking at a way of getting these sorts of disputes out of the normal run-of-the-mill CCMA dispute resolution. The second is that the premise is that if you can negotiate or earn $1.2 million, you can negotiate. If 3 months is not enough for you, you can negotiate longer periods, which you always have to comply with. So those golden handshakes, you can write them into the contract. So it's got a 2-year running period where it's only effective 2 years after it comes into effect. And people who take top executive positions earning over that threshold will then negotiate when they take a job. I'm only going to take this job if you give me at least 6 months notice if you want me out, or if you also give me my share options if you want me out. Whatever it is, those kind of commercial negotiations can regulate people at this level. They're not vulnerable workers who need to be able to go to the CCMA when the contract comes to an end. That's the idea.
Okay. The other thing is 189A, which deals with retrenchment. It introduces a new section that says the consultation period of 60 days may be extended if there is a good reason for that. And it deletes subsection 19, which deals with a fairness test of what is a fair retrenchment, substantively fair retrenchment, to bring it in line with Section 189. Now remember, Section 189 deals with basically small type of retrenchments. There's no substantive test of fairness there. In 189A, which is generally big retrenchments, although they're all kinds of anomalies, there is a test. And this is an attempt to make sure that those two substantive tests are the same and not different, and it leaves it up to the courts to determine that case. That is an issue that has been opposed by business on the basis that that was a deal that was struck in the 2002 amendments. 190 deals with the date of dismissal to try and clarify that. I don't think it's controversial. There is also section 191 which deals with the agreed extension of the conciliation period and dealing with the jurisdiction of the CCMA with regard to operational requirements dismissals. If you recall, you want us to stop there.
Just the issue of dismissal. What sometimes happens is that people, an employer terminates an employee's contract, but then doesn't want the employee to re-enter the premises, for example. And he or she is quite willing to pay 3 months, 4 months, you know.
Yes.
So would this, a clause such as this, not entitles the employee to still have access to the place of work?
As you say, particularly in firms where there's intellectual property, they often just pay you out in those periods and say, go, because they don't want the intellectual property stolen. They would be able to do that. I don't think so.
It specifically says that, like, in Scotland, all pays the employee in lieu of that notice. So, in other words, it contemplates that you can give the notice in money instead of time, so that your employment terminates today, but he has the money for 3 months, or whatever's been agreed, 6 months, whatever else has been agreed.
Just to move on to the operational requirements. I'll deal with very quickly the other issue, operational requirements. If you're dismissed, if you're retrenched, Bhuti is retrenched from the South African Communist Party, and it is only him that is retrenched. He may go to the CCMA and adjudicate his dismissal there. Okay? If he was employed by an employer that only employed 10 people, he could go there as well. So it's an attempt to try and ensure that small businesses can be dealt with at the CCMA, which is less costly for them and for the employees. Single dismissals, a single retrenchment, and small businesses. Now we'll come on to the stuff about labor brokers. So you should all wake up now. all wake up now, don't worry. I'm going to draw something just now. Okay, what happens is labor brokers are a very controversial area, and they are called temporary employment services. And a distinction has been drawn between 198 and a new 198A. Now, may I make a political comment? I know I'm not really allowed to, but there's a lot of debate about should labour brokers be regulated, or should labour brokers be banned, or should we allow them just, you know, laissez-faire, free, whatever it is. Banning is a form of regulation, so it's just a particular form of that. The questions that they have been grappled with are very key, difficult issues. And there is the case in Namibia of dealing with labor brokers where they were banned and it was held to be unconstitutional. And there's been a lot of debate, particularly within government and the other social partners, about whether a ban of this nature would in fact be unconstitutional or not. And I think government came to the conclusion that it would be unconstitutional. But what they've attempted to do is to regulate in such a way that the ills associated with labour brokers are prevented. So there is no agreement amongst the social partners on these clauses. Okay? And one has got to see that. I mean, business hasn't accepted it, labour hasn't accepted it formally, and although I think FIDUSA has accepted it. But NACTU and COSATU haven't. So I'm putting up now what the scenario is. So there are two clauses that are important. The first is section 198, okay? And the next one is section 198A. Okay. Section 198 deals with temporary employment services, and it is basically like it was now. Okay? So you can say that this is the same as now. Alright? But there are clauses that are added in. Okay? So that's the first scenario. Section 198A is a more stringent regulation of temporary employment services, and it applies to employees below the threshold. Alright? And that threshold is the threshold in section 6.3. Section 6.3 of the BCA.
Currently 172,000 rand per year.
Currently 172,000 per annum. Okay, not per month.
We would love it to be per month.
Okay, so that's the first thing. So what the proposal attempts to do is to maintain, to a large extent, the status quo here for those above the threshold. The people below the threshold are more firmly regulated, and this is an attempt to say these are the more vulnerable workers. Okay? It's an attempt to look at more vulnerable workers there. Now, the question has been debated about what should the threshold be and how much should it be, and you know, all those come to things. Okay. The first thing is that, but there are some amendments here which I'm going to put up. Okay? And whatever I say here also applies here. Okay? To these amendments. People see what I'm saying. So, an employee bringing a claim where the TES, I'm going to use the word TES for labor broker, and the client are jointly and severally liable. Now, at the moment, if they break the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, if they don't implement an arbitration award, those kinds of things, they are jointly and severally liable, all right, in terms of Section 198. But the courts have said, oh, no, but even though they're jointly and severally liable, you must first go against them, and then you can go against them if you don't get any joy at going against the TES. And that has frustrated the processes tremendously, because it takes you 8 months to go against the TES, you get no joy of that, and then you must now start to go against the client. It makes it very, very, very difficult. So you can go against them jointly, together at the same time. Okay. The same thing go against together. I'm going to put that there like that. organizer for SATU, I think. Then, the same thing for an inspector. Alright? So, department inspector can issue a compliance order against all of those, or enforce against both of them. They don't have to go against the labor broker first, and then against the TES. So if you get an order against you, if you say I'm owed my last month's salary, I'm bringing a claim against, I can bring it against both of them, and then I can execute against the client. Okay, because half the time these labor brokers operate from the boot of a car, and you can never find them. Now there are good labor brokers. I'm not suggesting, as in every area, they are good lawyers like me, and then they're bad lawyers like Chris. I'm glad I said that while he was out of the room.
the TES is the employer. Alright? Subject to joint and several liability, obviously. Alright? And after 6 months, the client is deemed, in other words, is for the purposes of the LRA. And I'm emphasizing this. Alright. So, after 6 months, the client is here. Is the employer. So for the first 6 months, alright, now, that's important for the purposes of the LRA. Because if you are a temporary employment service, then you can still be the employer for the purposes of UIS and those kinds of things. Okay, you can still provide that kind of service to the client. But for the purposes of the LRA, you are, the client is deemed to be the employer. Which means that you get protection for dismissal, organizational rights, everything, etc., in the LRA, you're deemed, your employer is not deemed to be the client. Okay? So that's the key thing. Okay. Now that 6 month period can be varied. Alright. That 6 month period can be varied. Yeah, I'm going to come to that now. First of all, the minister may, for certain categories of employees, say they can be employed by temporary employment services, but then he or she has to consult with NEDLAC about that. So he can make, she can make an administrative determination in relation. The 6 month is also can be varied if you're substituting an employee for the period of the substitution. Now, some people have maternity leave that's longer than 6 months, or they've gone on training, which is longer than 6 months. If you're substituting, then you can. And it can be varied by sectoral determination, right, and by collective agreement, am I right? Bargaining council collective agreement. So a bargaining council collective agreement. So if NUMSA and CISA at the Nickel and Engineering...
If they agree on four months.
Yeah, they can vary. They can agree on 4 months or they can agree on 8 months. They can vary. But the protection is there. The protection of electoral determination and the minister is there because there's consultation at NEDLAC about those two. And this is specific to when you're substituting an employee for a particular thing. Okay. So that 6 months can... put in those comments. So in other words, at this point, your contract is deemed to move from TES to client. Okay. Now, so in other words, you can never be in permanent temporary employment with a TES, which is the key problem that most people face. I mean, if you see the scenario is that employers use a TES to provide an employee indefinitely, which it can't happen anymore. It could happen if you're under 198, but as soon as you're below 172, it can never happen. And the way in which that is expressed in the LRA, now I've drawn it in this kind of way, but the way it's expressed is that a TES is the employer provided they're providing temporary services. Okay? And temporary services is defined as up to 6 months, or a period or category of employees determined by the minister, and that this 6 months can be varied by those fees. That's how it is defined or written in the legislation or proposed legislation. Galipi, am I misinterpreting anything here? We've been through some interpretations, sometimes I can't remember what we agreed to, but
under what clause will the following be allowed? Because I think it will be should be allowed. For example, let's say Mediclinic makes use of nurses. You use people sometimes over weekends and so on. And your normal staff needs to go on, you know, they have their days off, etc. So now I, as a registered nurse, will register with the Temporary Employment Service and say I make my services available over weekends and so on. Sometimes it's even in addition to another full-time job. And then that person gets sent on weekends and during night shifts to the various Mediclinic hospitals in the particular metro. Okay. My agreement with my temporary employment services can continue for years, for more than 6 months. It's one client, it's Mediclinic. And I get sent to Stellenbosch, to Verlegen in Somerset West, to N1. I don't see the clause that will allow a temporary employment service still to deal with me in that way. And surely, I don't think there's any thought of excluding that kind of arrangement. Yet, which clause will allow for that, except 24-hour? Because, but I think those people normally work long hours.
Yeah, you see, I think maybe you can help me out here, that's what the question is. What's fundamental to this process is, when you're talking about applying the relationship, okay, you've got the client, which might be different. It might be this hospital this time, it might be that hospital this time. You've got the team head. And you write the employee. That relationship is a contract of employment. Okay. That relationship is an assignment. Okay, it's not a contract. Okay. What we're saying is that you become the employer after 6 months. So if you just simply bang there for an assignment which is only on a weekend or for a week or whatever it is, you always fall within this period. Your employer remains the CES for the purposes of the LRF. And it was precisely those kinds of examples that motivated the need for the CES here in that 6 month period. I'm a lawyer, my secretary disappears. I need a secretary for a week. I don't want to employ someone for a week. From a TES, I do so. They remain a TES employee. So you were in that 6 month period. Okay.
I mean, a potentially more, potentially more difficult situation if you do that regularly once a week for 2 years. Yeah. But they're continuously different. Sometimes you come back to the same hospital, and you go to the same hospital a few times, and then you go to another one, and it's all for the same group. And then the question is, does that affect this analysis? Because the 6 months is not a continuous, it doesn't say a full time employment. It's a 6 month period. So even if you work one day a month, on your seventh month, are you now, I don't know, those are hard cases, but it's quite difficult to know.
Or you work every Sunday, as a holiday job.
Yeah, as a day.
And you can't see 24 hours in a month.
Yeah.
So, can I ask something? What's to stop the TES from, on 5 months and 29 days, retrenching the cleaner that he's giving the client and hiring another one 2 days later to do the same job?
Yeah,
from the same client. So your concern is the rollover. So yeah, you replace and you start a whole new process.
Yeah.
6 months, 6 months. You just, so nothing changes for you.
Yeah.
Says the termination of an employee's assignment for the purpose of avoiding the operation of this section is a dismissal. So it's saying that the person is removed from the client is effectively dismissed if the purpose of removing them is to try and avoid the rollover.
But you said those people only get the right to dismissal after they've served 6 months.
No, that's when dismissal claims are against the client. They still got
dismissal
claims against the labour broker.
Who is your dismissal claim against? Okay. So 1984 says the termination of a temporary of an employee's assignment with a client for the purpose of avoiding the operation is a dismissal. So that constitutes a dismissal.
Now, at the moment, as we sit right here, surely they've got those rights now in the current situation under labour brokers, employees.
Yeah.
So basically, for employees for the first 6 months, if they're not dismissed, if they are dismissed, nothing's changed for them in the legislation.
1984 extends the ground to for the purposes of avoiding the operation of Section 3B.
Oh, that doesn't exist.
No, okay,
because there's no 3B.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. You see, what happens with temporary employment services generally is the client comes along and says, "Lulu, I don't like you anymore. Go to temporary employment services, get rid of Lulu." Temporary employment service says, "Sorry, client says I must get rid of you. That's an operational requirement. Terribly sorry." But there's no payment involved in that process. There's no misconduct in itself, it's not performed poorly, and there's no real operational requirement. But the TES says, I have got an operational requirement. If I don't do what the client says I must do, then... So that clause is an attempt to try and prevent that from happening.
Have you answered that question?
But my view is that for 6 months period, each assignment is a different contract. But if your nurse is on a 6 month period every week at the same client, it's a different scenario.
Sorry, so this assignment story could also be used by dodgy TES people.
Yeah.
To get rid of me every 6 months.
Move you out.
In fact, that's what some TES would do. They argue that. They say, you've not been dismissed. You've just lost your assignment. You're still employed by me, but I don't have any work for you and I can't pay you.
But that's what I'm saying. So we change all the legislation and nothing changes for the workers.
No, but that's why in 1984 we said a termination of the assignment, not the termination of employment.
What is the loophole then?
Oh, what's the loophole? You know what? My mental audience is that you have to understand that human beings are learning animals. And employers will learn something and find the loophole, and employees will find something and find the loophole. We're all learning animals. So
we'll close it in 5 years.
And we'll have to close it in 5 years' time.
If you can anticipate the loophole now, great. But we haven't been able to anticipate it at this stage. I mean, that point is probably why this is an area where, unlike the strikes clauses where government proposed them and business thought they could do better but agreed with them, and in other areas there is consensus between government and labour, this is one area where labour believes that the 6 month period should be naught and business believes that it should be 24 months, so a longer period, because they say this doesn't adequately cater for genuine
fluctuations in production, that's what they say. So it is an area where it is the most contested area where government is attempting to try and draw a sale somewhere between. And I think the real danger from businesses' point of view, or what business has been saying, if I was to say it, is that it is inevitable that when you call, for whatever you want to call it, upgrade the quality of jobs that for these workers, you're going to reduce the number of workers in employment. And that is a trade-off that has caused political ructions. It's a trade-off that is particularly sensitive in the current economic climate. And it's a trade-off that labor doesn't want business to try and take advantage of, or to exploit workers for longer because there's an economic crisis, and whatever it is. But I don't think anybody can seriously say that we're not going to have a reduced number of people being used in an enterprise because the security of employment is improved and the cost of employment is up. So as soon as you've got cost, I mean, the only regulatory assessment that has been done says there's a thing called elasticity of employment demand or something, which means if you put cost up 1%, then you reduce employment by 0.7%. So as soon as you increase the job security and cost in an enterprise that had people quite easily would just pick up the phone to the labor broker and say, I'm going to need 20 people, extra people this month, or I'm going to keep the people I had for another couple of months, those kinds of hiring decisions are going to be made a lot more carefully and they're going to be more costly. So that's the real trade-off here. The government is, I don't want to say walking a tightrope or treading on a razor blade or what it's doing, but it's a very, very difficult position to try and marry the interest, because nobody could say morally it's not a good idea to give workers in this class an extra category, an extra security of employment. But what is going to be the consequence is something which is not, it's really guesswork. I would suggest that it's some suck, and you're only going to know in 3 or 5 years' time when you review this, by retrospective research, it appears, what the impact was on the labour market. And it's not, I mean, the only thing, I don't know whether it's comforting to know, it's not the only problem that's being experienced here. I mean, it's a global problem that enterprises are being fragmented vertically and horizontally, and there's more different classes of people being shipped around to do work more efficiently. And as you try and, in the legislative noose, catch them in and tie them firmly to the enterprise and improve their job security, you are going to, employers' response to that is they're either going to look for loopholes or hire less people. And it's very difficult to know. So that's the, I mean, I don't know how you make that decision. Employers' business has said they believe you should do more research on that. It's like Labour said you must do research on what causes strike violence. Business says you must do more research on what the impact is going to be on the number of jobs before you implement a measure that increases the cost and security of employment. They might secretly want to, you might think they're secretly wanting to exploit workers for longer, but the problem the government's got is that it's got a jobs crisis. So how you juggle all those balls is the task of government, and they, I think this is how they're trying to juggle it.
Can you tell us about the study
or any labor legislation for that matter. Even if that 18 to 24 months exists, what will be the difference of the argument that a business is advancing at the level of network if that 24 months does exist? Because that 24 months will be nothing else but to say, now, the client, for the purposes of the LRA, after that 24 months, the same thing exists as if it was 6 months.
I think what the way it increases the cost of employment, and we haven't talked about all the provisions that go with this, is typically, and this is a burning issue, so one might as well mention it. Temporary employment, when people are hired through labour brokers, they are often, not always, but often paid less than the full-time employees of the establishment. Yeah. And that is only because the full-time employees are earning more than the minimum. If full-time employees are earning on the minimum, the labour brokers have to be paid the minimum. They can't be paid less than BCA or sectoral determination minimum. So when they're brought into the enterprise, they could be paid at minimum rates, whereas other workers in the enterprise have negotiated 50% better than minimum rates over the years through their effective trade union negotiations. So for workers, it undermines wages to have labor brokers brought in to service a contract, because it means that the employer can get cheaper labor, still above the minimum, or on the minimum, but not necessarily the same as the other workers in the enterprise. So that's one way in which it increases cost. And the other is the employer's decisions around ending the relationship. And so at the moment, for example, the employer, and we'll just use a practical example, if the employer is in the motor vehicle industry in the Eastern Cape, and BMW asks it to manufacture a whole lot of parts that are going to be used in the factory in Germany. Or there's an increase, sudden increase in orders for right-hand drive vehicles. So the motor vehicle manufacturer in the Eastern Cape can say, I think this is going to take us 12 months, this contract. And now how are they going to staff that contract? At the moment, they can use some of their existing production capacity, but they can just get in temporary workers through labor brokers to run the balance of that contract. And they can get them in at lower rates because the established norms and negotiations have over years paying better than minimum rates. So what the employers now would have to do is say, hang on, if I'm going to have to pay the same as the other workers in the enterprise after 6 months, I mean, if I'm in a short-term contract for less than 6 months, I can still do this, have differential wages in the enterprise. But as soon as it goes beyond 6 months, I'm going to have to pay at the higher level. So it's going to have a bigger cost implication. So it might mean instead of using 100 workers on this new contract, I'm going to use 80 or something like that. And you know, there are other enterprises which have typically used at their warehouse operation, they have 500 permanent employees and 100 people from time to time, all the while time changing through labor brokers. But now they're going to have to say, hang on a second, I think I must reduce, I need to create more permanent posts and reduce my use of labor brokers. I don't need all 100 extra people. I could do with only 80, something like that. So these things are going to have a direct knock-on effect on employment. But that I can't say. I'm not an economic expert. I'm not an economist. That's just what, business has said. We've looked at it and done our own analysis applying the previous impact assessment that was done in 2010, and this is the kind of impact it's going to have. And they've been calling for a new impact assessment to say, what impact is this going to have on employment? I can't say. All I can say as a lawyer is that it seems that it's going to increasing the security of employment, and the wages of a class of workers above the minimum must increase the cost of employment. That seems to me to be logical. And typically it comes at a cost.
And can I just add that what there is, and I haven't said, is that there is an equal pay for equal work provision that applies after the 6 months. Okay? In this scenario. So you can't have the employed by the temporary employment service, and after the 6 months you're deemed to be the client employee, then you must be paid at the same rate as the other client employee. Okay, so there's an equal.
I suppose the argument pro and core you need to engage at a policy level. I think what we've tried to do is a sense of what has come up. There are clearly trade-offs between security, decent employment, and cost of employment, and all those kinds of things that are at play here. But I suppose at the end of the day, we're also going to look at the extent to which there has been a huge burgeoning labour broker segment of the economy, which has an effect of allowing workers, allowing employers to pay below what they've negotiated into the staffing for essentially since about 1995, which is when the labour brokers really took off. So you have this two-tier employee sector burgeoning and an attempt to try and get out of those collective bargaining arrangements. And that's been part of the problem, is that not only job security here, but that you are being paid at a much lesser rate with much less benefit.
That brings me to the third point in this situation. Whereas you raised it under violation of this 6 months of this period, which, by the way, labor and business have not agreed with what government is proposing. But the government is trying to bring these two parties together. It's a compromise position, and this is what, if I may put it that way. Be that as it may, it looks like to me from what I'm sitting that we are making one legislation to have a number of legislation within it. There's one labor relations act. Within this labor relations act, you will find your chapters that deal with a variety of issues. But within the same chapter, that then will have different sections that deal with the same issue. Because you have sections that deal with collective agreement. And we're talking about that before we came to this subject. About organizational rights and a number of things. Okay? And within the organizational rights, in fact, within collective bargaining, you have those agreements that are reached for conditions of employment. Now, you have conditions of employment in the same industry or in a company level. Now, within the result policy of employment that establishes all conditions for all employees in the industry. But now, because of the result triangle approach, where there's a test, there's a client, and then the contract of employment is between the employee and test, and then between the employee and the client is a settlement. Now, because now it's no longer termed as a contract of employment here, it's termed as an assignment, whatever name that is given. So therefore, you must be paid below the collective agreement. I think within one company, from where I'm sitting, that's the situation. But the at the same time you have your equal pay for equal work. And that exists, I understand that those are amendments of the employment agreement. So when those amendments go through of the employment agreement, they will not be applicable to some employees who are in the same establishment. So you will have two categories of employees where they are, some are covered by the legislation of the country, some are not. But I think the point that you raised earlier that you
to attack it.
I mean, Anton says we must, that's not our job to run these sort of debates. But if I could just make two quick points about that. Your point about collective bargaining is a very good one. There are many industries already where at industry level, we talked about industry bargaining arrangements earlier, they've agreed, for example, I think in road freight, that employers will only employ up to a certain proportion of the total workforce through labour brokers. And unions and employers have agreed that that would govern, be appropriate in that industry, bearing in mind how they need labour brokers. And there's a strong argument that it is more appropriate to deal with the issue through bargaining. There's another argument which also says the LRA only sets minimum standards, not minimum standards in the same way that the BCA does, not of conditions of employment, but minimum collective bargaining and dismissal rights, and that the idea is that they promote union organization and that you then negotiate either at workplace level, at sectoral level, or at regional, geographically regional level for better conditions than are provided by the LRA. That's what happened in road freight about labor brokers, for example. So there is an argument that says this kind of, what one of your problems you've got and the government has in trying to get the right structure is that they're trying to do something that would work for the motor vehicle industry in the Eastern Cape, that's going to work for the legal industry when they want secretaries, and it's going to work for your engineering firm in Porfighter as well. And it might well be that it's very difficult to come up with the blueprint in legislating actually what happens in every case. But then just the only other point, the only other response I wanted to make is that I think it's dealt with in that, the idea that I apologize, I've forgotten your other point, or what my other response was to you.
But I mean, this is precisely the reason that we allow bounding council to vary these provisions, because that's to cater for those industry-specific areas. And I don't think the proposal that we put on the table prevents that. Even as LRA stands now, the bounding council do not have the power to vary everything. They can vary certain section of the law. And this is exactly what is introduced here. And I don't think that there's a contradiction in what you are doing and what you are arguing in terms of the industries themselves. If they believe that, for example, that they want 18 months, they can vary that in 18 months. Therefore, then it takes all those issues beyond that, I mean, in terms of the 6 months and all those issues. They can vary and make it 3 months if they want to. I mean, the proposal that we put on the table is exactly to cater for industry-specific arrangement that parties
are entering. Just to your chair, I remember the second point, I'll make it very, very quick. But just that actually unions can now demand that all workers in this enterprise, including through labour brokers, fixed term or anything, get paid at the same rate. That's a subject matter. It can be bargained already, because it's a related point about using collective bargaining to regulate this. This would regulate it by law.
Okay, can I very briefly then, Chair, explain the fixed term and part time? Because it's not as complex. Maybe I can just explain it in writing. Fixed term contract deals with temporary employees, alright? In other words, you've got a contract for only a short period of time. And what has happened is that employers tend to put people on fixed-term contracts and then just extend them. And you never, a lot of employees, particularly at the lower levels, don't get into permanent employment, which means their benefits are very different and those kinds of things. So in line with, I think, what other countries have put up. In essence, what has been put up here is that you can only have a fixed-term contract for a minimum period of 6 months unless you can justify it. Okay? But this, again, only applies below the threshold. So, shall I just draw that because I'm going to give you a bit of time. So what these amendments have attempted to do is to create
a situation where there's flexibility above the threshold and less flexibility where there's vulnerability. I mean, in essence, that's the notion. Okay? So with fixed term contracts, I'll call them FTs, not full time, fixed term. Okay, this applies only below the threshold, which is again 172,000 at the moment per year. Okay? But it doesn't apply, and I'll put it like that, meaning it doesn't apply to small businesses. And a small business is very much along the lines of the small business determination in terms of the BCEA. So less than 10 employees. Okay? And it doesn't apply to less than 50 employees, all right, in the first, is it 4 years or 2 years?
2 years.
In first 2 years of operation. Okay. So, it's attempting to regulate fixed term in areas of vulnerability, but give special dispensation to small businesses and start up small business. Okay? I think this was generally drawn from the kind of German legislation. And then, in relation to this, fixed term, you can have a fixed term for 6 months without any reason. So I can say, Andrikas, I'm employing you, I'm going to put you on a fixed term contract for 6 months, even though that's normally a position I would move to a permanent person. But once you go beyond 6 months, you must have a justification. Alright? And what the Act does is it sets out guidelines as to what would be considered a justifiable reason for a fixed term. And those are listed in subsection 4 of 198B, and some of those there's total consensus on all of them, but they're are guidelines. So if you're replacing another employee who's temporarily absent, that is a fixed term contract. That's uncontroversial. Is it engaged on account of a temporary increase in the volume of work which is not expected to endure beyond 12 months? That was Labour was concerned about, because how do you determine that, those kinds of things. Is a student or recent graduate who is employed for the purposes of being trained or gaining work experience in order to enter a job or profession? So that's your Catholic intern. Is engaged to work exclusively on a genuine specific project that is a limited or defined duration? So you've got a project. Now, it has to be a genuine project. You can't redefine every work as a project. It's engaged for a trial period for no longer than 6 months for the purpose of determining the employee's suitability or employment. So instead of having probation, you can have a fixed-term contract for 6 months. It's engaged to perform seasonal work. Is a non-citizen is being granted a work permit. Is engaged on an official public work scheme or similar public job creation scheme. Is engaged on a position which is funded by an external source for a limited period. Has reached the normal or agreed retirement age applicable to the employee's business. So you can put people on fixed-term contracts for greater than 6 months if they've reached 65, for example. If it's concluded or renewed in contravention of subsection 3, then it's deemed to be indefinite. So that's in essence the issue there. And once there's also an equal pay for equal work provision, So you can't put people on a fixed-term contract to pay them less than you would for a permanent person. And then specifically for the construction industry, there's this clause, sub-clause 10, which says if you put on a contract for 24 months, because if you're building a project like a power station, I don't know, a soccer stadium, it's going to take 24 months. If you're not going to be given another job after the 24 months, you must pay a severance package. Okay? Which is 1 week for every completed year as well. Then lastly, we come to part-time, and then I think we can... there's one other thing after part-time, and then I think we finish. Part-time, again, when you talk about part-time, you're not talking about someone who comes in for 6 months. You're talking about someone who comes in from 8 to 12 during the day. Okay? So you can be a part-time, fixed-term employee. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. What you've got to consider here is your comparison, and there is an ILO convention in relation to this, and this is where we drew it from, the ILO convention. When we talk about a comparable full-time employee, okay, that's what you constantly are looking at. Now, again, this doesn't apply. It applies to employees below the threshold of 172. Okay? It doesn't apply to people above the threshold. Flexibility above, more regulation for the vulnerable, or more vulnerable, I should say. Again, it does not apply to employers with less than 10 employees. So there's a small business exclusion. And it doesn't apply to employers with less than 50 employees in the first 2 years. So that's your startup provision. And then basically what it says is there has to be equal pay or equal work. There's a provision around that. When you compare it to a comparable full-time employee, proportionately, obviously. So you can't pay a less hourly rate for that person. And how do you work out who this person is? Well, you look at the person in the same workplace. And if you can't look at the person in the same workplace, you look at the person, similar person in the company. Okay, so that you can deal with regional differentiation. You first of all look at the full-time employee in Cape Town before, and if there's no such person, then you look at the full-time employee in Johannesburg.
In Port Fulton.
You can cope with that kind of comparison. And then, if there is a dispute about any of these things, you can pay less if it's justified. But all of these things, you can pay less if it's justified. And the issues that you look at in relation to justification are merit, seniority, quantity of work, quality of work, and other criteria which that can't be discriminatory criteria. And any disputes about these issues go to the CCMA. And then the rest of the proposals are, I think, uncontroversial, except in the new section 100B, which you should note, because I think this is an attempt try and deal with problems associated with things like subcontracting and those kinds of things. And if you look at that
200B existed, for the purposes of this act and any other employment law, an employer is to one or more persons who carry on associated or related activities or businesses by or through an employer if the intent or effect of their doing so is or has been directly or indirectly defeat the purposes of this act or any other employment law. So you can't open and shut different businesses and create different employers to try and circumvent the Labor Relations Act. The old trick in the old days was, as soon as you got, you had a dismissal case against you, the employer would shut down that business and open up the next business around the corner. It was exactly the same business, but it was a new corporate entity. You can't do that kind of thing. And then if more than one person is held to be the employer of an employee in terms of subsection 1, those persons are jointly and severally liable. So that's an attempt to deal with a range of subcontracting arrangements where people try and escape liability of labor legislation. That is the LRA. We haven't gone to the BPA, but I would imagine we've gone on the constitution.
There are questions that members would like to ask quickly, because we are actually running out of time. Honorable Williams.
Jackson, I thought I just want some clarity around probation. You talked about probation when you talked about the fixed term contract. We're back to extend probation after the 6 months? Or how does that work? So you can't have probation and then extend that probation after 6 months.
No,
you can't be on probation forever.
No, that clause just says that specifically, and it follows comparable arrangements in Germany and other European countries that our LRA has not followed closely, but effectively saying there is a trial, you could use a fixed term contract for a trial, effectively a trial period. So, but it can't be longer than 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah, as you can all see, we ran out of time. There's the sitting at 2, and Comrade Manamela had to leave to attend the WIPARI meeting, and the rest of the other members who left, they didn't say where they are going, and it's so sad that people come late to the meeting, and then they sit here for about an hour, sign the register, and then from there they go, because then it defeats exactly what we are trying to do, sharing information, learning from those who were at the center of the formulation of this legislation, and you cannot get that except from them. Whatever you get will be second hand to, these are the people who dealt with this legislation, and those members have lost this opportunity. We're going to make an arrangement that we reconvene again next week so that we deal with the rest of the issues. And this will be good because during this break and over the weekend we'll be able to go to discuss it with other people and then check what other further questions that we can ask, to further deepen and broaden our knowledge of this matter on the table now. I'll give you an opportunity.
Thank you. Just in short, can I just say thank you very much, and thank you for allowing the presenters to go a little bit slower so that people like myself can also follow and understand. And perhaps it's because it's the second time Mr. Mkaliki has already tried his best to educate me. But thank you very much for this morning. I found it most valuable.
Thank you very much. I just have thanks that the reason why laws are changed or there's an attempt to review laws is because our reality, our laws clashes with reality in most instances. What you see on the street in real life differs from what is on paper. It is because of this you know, inequalities of treatment of workers and actually abuse of the system of labor brokerage, that we decided, no, we need to close these gaps. If it wasn't because of that, there wasn't going to be any need for us to do the review. We are addressing real issues, and it's important for members to take this exercise very, very seriously. Let me take this opportunity to thank the presenters. You've done a very good job. And even those of us, I mean, we are not that new at NetLeg, but we can actually check what was happening there, you know, through your presentation. I hope maybe other people at NetLeg were here, those who are representing others were here, so that we can, you know, kind of get even more. But I don't think we have missed anything of what has happened at NetLeg. Thank you. And thank you very much. And those members who stayed here, who were here from 8 in the morning until now when we knock off, I thank you very much. This will make our committee vibrant. And thanks to the staff, everybody. Thank you very much until we meet next week. Thank you, Brian. Sorry, before, there's an announcement. The Portfolio Committee on Mineral Resources extend an invitation to members of the Portfolio Committee on Labour for a briefing to be held with Aurora Empowerment Systems, Department of Mineral Resources, Labour, Joint Provisional Liquidators, NUM and Solidarity on the progress made regarding the crisis in the Grootvlei and Orkney mines. So this meeting is for Wednesday, 30th May, 9 o'clock to 13 hours. The Speaker of Parliament has formed an ad hoc committee to look at abuse of human rights on the farms. So I'm sitting in that committee. We'll be requesting 5 members from our committee to be part of that. That would be 3 plus 1, 1. We all understand what that means. So, yeah. At least this thing is on. We'll keep all the rest of the members who are not in that committee wired on what are the on what is progress. The ILO, our application was kicked out. They only allowed 2 people to go, and only for 3 days. It doesn't make sense. How do you go to Geneva for a 2-week conference and only go there for 3 days? But anyway, it's okay. That is all for now.
Cool.
Next week.